Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster is on the air. Talk to Bob now. 210-599-5555.
All right, and a very, very good Saturday morning to everybody out there on this this Saturday before the big eclipse. Hopefully we'll have sunshine for that portion of the day, and then it can just rain like mad afterwards for the next two or three days. And weatherman keep vacillating back and forth. It will or it won't, or it will or it won't, but it should be an interesting event. I'll tell you the advice that my sheriff gave me, and that is stay home and lock your gate. He said we're only expecting an extra 400,000 cars on the roads that this weekend. So it'd be a good day. Just go to the nursery, stock up on some plants and fertilizer and azomite and all those other things you need, and lock the gate and stay home and enjoy gardening. Got a lot of things to talk about, a lot of things going on, but most important is what is on your mind. My engineer Greg tells me that Don and John are waiting to talk, so let's just get started with phone calls. We talk about other things later. Good morning, Don.
Good morning, Bob.
Good morning.
Don, I'm here at Corpus Christi. My asparagus is doing pretty good, but it's been putting out some real small, 3/16 or less sprouts, coming the way up straight up. Should I cut those things off? And I've been cutting them right now off, or should I let them keep coming out?
How long have your plants been planted, Don?
This is the second year that I've started, harvest.
Well, if this were the fifth or sixth year, I'd tell you to cut them off and eat them. At this point, though, since your plants that's because they've stayed on too long. Let them go ahead and make their ferns. We're into April now, and it's about time to stop harvesting and let them make their ferns for the summer's growth. And of course, the more green they have, the stronger the plants will be, the more you can harvest next year. So nothing wrong with those little ones. It's just a sign of young plants that don't have the root system established. They will in another year or two. So, at this point, I just let them go ahead and make their ferns, fertilize them, water them, and that's about all you have to do for the next 11 months or 10 months, and then you'll be back to a good harvest.
Yeah, what fertilizer should I put on?
I do two things. I, in the early spring, will put on some of the granular growing green product from Medina or Texas Tea from Maestro Grow or Premium Lawn and Garden fertilizer from Nature's Creation. Those are all good fertilizer products. And then through the growing season, I mix up that Medina Has to Grow plant and use that every chance I get. I tell people, do it every 2 weeks if you can. Realistically, I probably get around to it every 3 or 4 weeks. But just a good liquid organic fertilizer, again, like the Hastero plant or their new, when they call liquid fish blend, the asparagus will love either one of those.
Yeah, well, these come up. They come up real, grow up real fast. I mean, like overnight,
come up.
And they shoot up. But they're just they're tough, and they just, and then they start, spreading out, but I thought maybe it's time to start, peter it out, as far as I've been doing pretty good this year. I did pretty good.
At this point, it's time to just go ahead and let them make their fronds, and it doesn't matter whether it's a big, thick stem or a little stem. Still got the same green foliage, still carrying on the same photosynthesis and making those roots and the plants stronger for next year's growth and blooming. So at this point, fertilize, water, keep them, treat them like you would any other plant in the garden.
I'm having hell with that nut grass. That nut grass is trying to dig it out. It's just trying to suffocate down another grass. It's just silicate those stuff.
It
just
keep it on the dry side and put, liquid rather than dry molasses, but mix up a fairly strong molasses solution. I put about half a cup to a gallon of water. Water it with that about every 2 weeks, and that creates so much beneficial microbial activity in the soil that the nutgrass doesn't like it. The nutgrass loves lousy anaerobic soil, and if you start making the soil really good, it will gradually just rot away. So, and the molasses will be good for everything else, but make that pretty strong molasses solution. Use it every couple of weeks, and it's not going to be an overnight thing, but you'll look back a few weeks around and just say, oh my gosh, the nut's edge isn't around anymore. So that's your best defense. You'll never dig it out. I can promise you that. It might be good exercise, but it's an exercise in futility.
I called around. I said, but you crawl around and you dig it out. I'll dig that around in the dirt there, but you mess around and you'll dig up a real good, you know, asparagus. You know, yeah. If someone picks it up.
Yeah,
that's what I'm doing. Pull them out. So
yeah, it's a well adapted weed, but like I say, keep it on the dry side, treat it with molasses, and it will go away. It doesn't really hurt anything. I mean, it's a nuisance, but unless you're growing potatoes or something like that, and sometimes those spears will go right through them. But old Malcolm Beck, you know, told us one time that. He said the healthiest field of corn he'd ever seen in his life was just growing in a sea of nuts edge. So it's not really harmful. It's just it's just a nuisance. But, you know, fairly dry, plenty of molasses, and it will rot out and go away given a little time.
Okay. Appreciate it, Bob.
Always a pleasure. Good to talk to you. You get out and have a good weekend.
Yeah, everything else is doing great. Paint is up 4 feet tall or more. Everything's good shape, so.
Well, you just do a rain dance for us. That's the main thing we need, and we actually need a small flood now to put some water back in the lakes and rivers and aquifers, but maybe we'll get through a couple of sunny days, and they're giving us a pretty good chance. So if you're a good rain dancer, get out and work on it later this week.
Okay, appreciate it, Rob. Talk to you
later.
My
pleasure, Don. Thank you, sir. Bye. Goodbye. Next in line is John. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Bob. Well, that is absolutely amazing because you were just talking with the previous caller about half of my conversation with you, which was the nut's edge. And I couldn't remember. I've written notes 100 times of how much molasses to use, and I was thinking it was either a cup or a half cup. So I ended up spraying 6 ounces out of my Dial-N-Spray sprayer. And you say you can't dig it up. I'll tell you what I have done at this point. I have a fence around the garden, a deer fence, basically. To keep it, you talked to me last year, I think, about putting mulch around the outside of my garden.
Right.
So that when the nut's edge grew back into the mulch, if I dug it out, when it grew back in, it would be easier to pull out. So I'm in the process of developing that setup, but I have completely dug out I have a bunch of totes, you know, those 18-inch wide, 2 foot,
right, right.
3 foot long, and 2 foot high totes, and I have dug the dirt out 18 inches deep, filled those totes up. I've set them on my backyard's gone since the drought, so I've just put some corrugated metal down on the ground, put the totes on top of that, and fill them up with the dirt that's in the between the post of that fence, and have now treated the soil that's removed, you know, to get any of the nuts down below that, and then I figure in the totes, it's been there for 2 weeks now, I figure if I leave it there another week or two, any of the nuts in there will start to develop runners, and I'll be able to just and I screen that. I mean, I run my soil through a quarter inch screen and taken all the rocks out of it, and there were basically no worms in it to begin with since the drought and everything, and nothing, no compost on top of it right now. So that's the extent I've gone to get rid of this stinking nut grass, but I do still have a couple of shoots that have come up, and so I sprayed the area where I've seen those shoots, and was curious about, you know, how much to spray and how often. So you answered both those questions in the first call. So thanks for that.
Well, it's kind of, it's interesting. And, you know, I get to talk to, you know, maybe 20, 30, at most 40 people in a show. But the other, however many tens of thousands of people are listening, people tend to have, you know, the same issues at the same time. So it's, you know, what you and I talk about is benefiting a lot of other folks out there. And it is kind of funny how often we get the same questions numerous times in one show. But you're doing it right. And like I say, it's nuts edges doesn't mean you're a failure. It means that you just got a nuisance out there that you can either ignore or, you know, go after it. You've gone after it, and it sounds like you're getting way ahead of it, and that's a good thing.
Well, I have. It is 90% gone in my garden, and it's mostly around the edges still. And I've talked to you about this last year or year before. Yeah. I did raised beds, took some water containers, you know, that were in the cages. A friend of mine wanted the cages, but he didn't want the container, so I just put those up. You know, cut them in half, put them up, and drilled holes in the bottom, put the corrugated metal around them, and have made raised beds out of those. But they're far enough into my garden that most of them are not in danger of getting nut grass coming up through the bottom of them.
Right.
So that's fine, but I want to keep it from getting under there because I don't want to get them into those beds.
Sure.
But, I do have some that is by my largest asparagus plant. The bottom, I probably have 30 shoots of asparagus coming up from that one plant.
Wow.
And I have nut grass. I can see a piece coming up from each side. So I don't know if the runner has gone all the way under that plant. And so keeping it watered, I'm never going to get rid of that. Even if because I sprayed the molasses around it, but I've watered it. I sprayed it last weekend. I watered it once midweek, you know, with a fairly heavy watering. And if I keep that going, I will never get rid of that nut grass, correct?
Well, it there are other things you can do. If I were doing it, and I don't know how portable your half-tote containers are, but as long as you've got, well, I'll just put it this way. I would probably cover the soil with something, black plastic, or this is one about the only place I can think of that I think it would be okay to use, you know, a piece of that weed block fabric. Put that down and then put some little blocks of something, just enough to raise your tote up 2 inches off the soil, and that should stop the nutsedge 100%. Because it'll just, you know, it'll just suffocate it. You're not interested in the toads putting roots down through the bottom of that down into the soil. So if you wanted to, I've known people to even take an old package of shingles or something and put that down, covering the soil with it, and then put their pots on top of it because, you know, they'll be around forever and nothing will try to come through those. So there are other things you can do, but I think it's probably more than you really need to do. It sounds like you've taken the appropriate steps and gotten things pretty well under control.
Well, I kind of do on that end. All right, to my second question concerning asparagus. I talked to you 2 or 3 weeks ago about some asparagus that I had bought. I left it out in the I was planting stuff, and it was just before the freeze that we had a couple months ago. I left it out, and it was underneath the box, the cardboard box that everything was sitting in, and I left it there. It went through the freeze, and I asked you about planting it. Well, you said, go ahead. It's not going to hurt to plant it. So I just stuck it in one of these raised beds just to see if it was going to come up.
Uh-huh.
Well, it didn't until I planted. I had one shoot that came up, but it died or disappeared. I kept it watered and everything. It just went away. So I thought, okay, well, these are just dead. So I planted green beans in that raised bed, one of those tubs, planted some green beans in there, and one green beans and then one next to it, two different types of green beans, bush beans. The ones in the other bed have come up. The one in the bed where I had the asparagus has not come up, but now the asparagus, three of the four asparagus plants, have shoots coming up.
Yeah.
So I've got these green beans planted in there and the asparagus plants. I didn't put them in the ground because I have some St. Augustine that had crept into the garden, and because everything in my backyard died, but I was watering the garden, I kept that St. Augustine alive, so I'm going to transplant it out to my front yard, where along the sidewalks where my St. Augustine died out there. So right. I didn't plant it where I planned to put it. So now I've got asparagus plants coming up in my green beans that hopefully will come up. But how long should I wait to transplant those asparagus plants?
Till next year. Till next January or so. Yeah, and
I figure I should leave them in the ground for a year.
Yeah, your asparagus is a perennial. Your green beans are going to be, you know, dead 6 weeks from now. You'll be planting another crop. So just let them grow and commingle, so to speak. Neither one's going to interfere with the other one. And just, you know, it's not really companion planting. I guess it is in a way, because the beans are going to improve the soil through their nitrogen collecting capacity. But at this point, I just let them share the space. When the green beans are gone, pull them up and let the asparagus have the whole area. And then, you know, next winter, when the asparagus goes into a semi-dormant state, that'll be the time to dig it and plant it wherever you like.
Good. That's what I kind of thought would be the answer, but I didn't know for sure. They're all at one end of that bed. They're just across the 3-year, three and a half foot spread of that bed. So they're close enough that they're too close for how I want to plant it permanently. But I'll let them grow this year and then dig them up at the end of the season.
Yeah, dig them up next January and just gently separate them and plant them back where you want them. And consider it, what is it they say? Experience is the name we all give our mistakes. It's something you've learned from, and, you know, nothing wrong there. You're going to get good green beans. Your asparagus is going to love the soil and the fertilizer you're giving the green beans. So it's going to be maybe the prettiest asparagus you have come next fall when you're thinking about transplanting it. So, as the old guy once said, just keep on keeping on.
Yeah. Now, volunteer little asparagus plants that come up around my existing asparagus. I have four that I see out in the garden right now. Mm-hmm. And if I don't trample them, can I transplant those? I did try to transplant one. It has one little white root. I transplanted it, and I don't know that it's still alive. I looked yesterday, and I could barely see. You know, it looked like it had kind of fallen over, but I'm maybe watering it too much.
Well, anyway, asparagus makes seed, and you'll have little plants come up around if you let it go to seed. Once again, if it's in the way, then you can try to transplant it. Some will make it, some won't. If it's not in the way, just leave it where it is, and then next winter when you're transplanting this one that's growing in your totes, transplant the others that are growing up the ground around it, and you'll just have that much more asparagus. It's hard to have too much good asparagus.
No, I agree. But they'll be big enough at the end of one growing season to go ahead and transplant them and have a little decent little root.
Absolutely. You fertilize those whenever you're fertilizing the plants around them, and you'll be amazed at how big they will be by the end of the growing season.
Great. Okay. I think that's all I had for you today, Bob.
Well, you get out and have a great weekend. I appreciate the call, and I know we'll talk again. And I believe we've got a second John waiting to talk. Is that correct, Greg?
Good morning, Bob.
Right. Good morning. How are you?
Doing fine. I'll start off with some tomato questions.
Okay.
I transplanted some tomato plants. They're about probably about a foot tall, so they were well on their way to growing, but they're just too crowded. I talked to you a few weeks ago, and I threw some seeds down that were 5 years old, and they came in.
Yep.
So I've never done actually potting. So I bought some 9-inch pots. I bought some soil in a bag because I have sand down here in Pleasanton, and I mixed up the sand, and I put a little quart bottle, and I put some Super Thrive, some fish, liquid fish food, and some molasses in. I put a couple capfuls of each, so two capfuls of each in the quart bottle. So I got a good color out of it, like a brown color.
Yep.
Now that when I when I transplanted them, you know, I kind of propped them up a little bit because they started being droopy. They came back great. I mean, they just, by Thursday morning, they look great. I'm outside yesterday. They look great. The sun hit them. And before I could know it, I turned around and, whoa, they were heading toward the ground. Uh-huh. So I propped them up and they came back. They came back great. I just checked on them about 20 minutes ago. They look fantastic. They're in 9-inch pots. I'm probably going to run it, you know, run them and see how they do. Put some cages in there. My main question is about the solution I'm using to spray with as a foliage. And can I put some burlap around them or use that shade cloth on top of the cage for a while to keep the sun, intense sun off of them so well, that I don't lose them?
Well, you're not going to lose them. And the sun isn't that intense this time of year. The thing that makes them droop is wind more than anything else. Dry wind will cause plants to droop even when they have plenty of water. And so anything you can do to keep the wind off of them would be a good idea. And some of the, like the insulate fabric is great stuff because it'll stop the wind, but still allow plenty of light to go through it to keep the young plants growing and coming up. So, you know, it's just be sure, always remember there's no such thing as too much water, but there is too often. So when you water, really, really thoroughly when you water, and then let them go and always feel the soil because sometimes even if plants are wet, they'll droop from the wind. So wait till that soil's dry about a knuckle deep, then water again. Your combination of Super Thrive molasses and the other things is great, but I would, you know, I would tend to use it more as a drench, and then maybe, every 2 weeks, I'd, you know, make a little bit of a seaweed molasses solution to spray on the foliage, but you don't want your tomatoes or any other plants to be getting all their nutrition through their leaves, or the plants have no reason to grow a good strong root system. Years sure. ago, we grew orchids commercially, and we were competing against, a bunch of growers getting the plants out of Taiwan, and they did almost exclusively foliar feeding, and their plants had horrible root systems, even though they were beautiful plants. We did almost exclusively feeding the growing medium, and the people we sold to told us our plants lasted 3 times longer than anybody else's. So occasional foliar feeding is fine, but don't make it your only thing. You want those plants to know what their roots are for and to develop a really strong root system. So I'd feed the soil with your mixture 3 or 4 times for every once that I sprayed it on the foliage.
Okay. And so the wind, it was windy down here. So the wind did that.
Right.
Okay. And a couple other quick questions. I have tomatoes on my tomato plant. Somebody told me a trick to attract bees is to put down a plate with a little bit of sugar water in it. Is there any truth to that? You know, around
well,
the tomatoes?
yes, but you don't need to do it because bees don't pollinate tomatoes. Tomatoes are not insect pollinated. Tomatoes are wind pollinated. And if there wasn't a bee in the same county, you'd still get good tomatoes. And if you had swarms of bees, you wouldn't get anything any better. That's a good thing if you're trying to attract bees. Do that around your squash and your cucumbers and things that are insect pollinated. But your tomatoes are wind pollinated, and they don't need the bees. The bees wouldn't know what to do with them. So, yes, it is a great way to bring additional bees into the garden, but you don't need it around your tomatoes.
Question about the potatoes. The potatoes are doing fantastic. The only way I can describe it is, I'll use the freckle analogy. It looks like they have, but they're bigger, big brown spots. And I don't know if it just the leaf centers got dried out. It doesn't look like bug problems. And the color is not dark green. And, you know, I did spray the leaves a few days ago with that solution I was just talking about. Is the big brown blotches, is that something to be concerned about? There's a lot of them.
It's hard to say. Are the leaves that are not affected, do they look good and healthy? Are the plants overall growing upright, or are they kind of droopy and weak looking?
They're growing well. I planted everything on the 27th of January, so everything is, you know, very well into the season, so to speak. And they've grown tall, and they're starting to flop to the side a little bit because they're kind of heavier a little bit.
Sure.
But some of the plants don't do that, but some of them are doing that. And so I don't know if they're at different stages.
Don't worry about how the plants do. That wind that you're talking about is what can kind of break them over every now and then. There are a lot of things that will cause brown leaves on potatoes. It can be sun. It can be, you know, some of the cold early on. It could be aphids, but not likely. At this point, just to, you know, if you're not going to eat the leaves, so don't worry about what they look like. If the plants are growing well, putting on new leaves, you're in good shape. And, you know, if they've been in since January, you can probably, if you like, take your finger and just kind of probe around in the soil around the base and pop out a few little new potatoes, you know, which taste awfully good any time you like. But for now, just, you know, fertilize and water. Do keep an eye out for aphids because that's one thing the plants can get. And you don't really care whether your potatoes are pollinated or not because you're not looking to make seeds. So I wouldn't worry about trying to attract bees into that area. Just work at keeping the plants growing vigorously, and you'll have new potatoes now and good-sized potatoes by the time summer gets here.
What's a good solution for the aphids and the critters that the leaf hoppers and everything that's you know, we haven't hit that season yet, but yeah. I think I saw some bugs out there the other day. I detect there's some, you know, we're going to get hit pretty hard pretty soon.
Yeah,
at least
keep in mind that you may have some beneficial insects which you don't want to kill, like ladybugs and things like that, but for most all of your troublesome insects, there is a product, and you can buy it pre-mixed. It's called Spinosad Soap, and it's a combination of insecticidal soap and spinosad, and that will take care of, you know, everything from aphids to spider mites to cabbage loopers to anything else that may get on the foliage of your plants. But spinosad soap is a primary thing you use in the garden to take care of any troublesome insects that show up.
And I've heard you talk about it before, so it looks like that's on my shopping list. Okay,
well, you
thanks,
get
Bob,
out.
For,
you have a,
for all the...
Always
okay,
a
thank
pleasure.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Okay. Always a pleasure to be here for you. Faye, hang on just a second. We're right up to news time almost, and you will be up as soon as that passes. Ah, it's a beautiful Saturday morning out there. I hope everybody's planning to spend some time outside today. Lots of things to do in the garden, lots of things to do in the flower beds. If you haven't fed your grass, the trees and shrubs and all those things, great time to get that done. Any yellowing? I should have mentioned in my last caller about azomite. That's just the most remarkable thing I've ever found for greening plants up. And golly, so many different things to talk about. We'll do that right after news here on KTSA Radio, San Antonio, Texas.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster is on the air. Talk to Bob now, 210-599-5555.
All right, we do have a couple of open lines, so you just heard that number. Give me a call, 210-599-5555. We're going to talk to Faye and then Elaine and then you. So back to the phone calls. Good morning, Faye.
Good morning, Bob. Good morning.
Good morning to you.
I haven't talked to you in a little while, and I've accumulated a few things to ask you about. And I'd like to start with one. I have a real good friend who is from Africa, and she and I both like growing banana trees.
Uh-huh.
And last year, you know, we got some beat up, but we have them up and running. And her question was that she hasn't had bananas on ever. Maybe ever. So could you tell us about the varieties and any information on bananas that would be helpful?
Well, the thing about bananas and the reason that, you know, some years you get them and some years you don't is the banana needs to have about 14 months of continuous growth, not freezing back. It needs to have a nice long growing season. And in years that we don't have any severe winter weather to freeze them back, they will make a stalk of bananas sometime the next spring or summer. so often, and I was in Houston yesterday, as a matter of fact, and was amazed at how many things apparently froze back for you guys this past season. Didn't realize how cold the winter had been, but chances are her plants have just, you know, frozen back with the cold winter weather, and it doesn't mean they won't come back and grow, but they're just going to grow until we have a year with a mild winter. And some people will wrap the trunk, some people will do all kinds of things to try to keep them from freezing back, and makes it much more likely that you will get a stalk of bananas. But that's what a banana tree needs. It just needs a long, more than a year, little over a year's time of uninterrupted growth, not being frozen back, and then it will make bananas. Now, its banana palm will produce the one big stalk that's coming up, will make one stalk of bananas, and that's it. That little central part of the tree will die, but the young sprouts coming out around it, they'll be up and, you know, probably to a size to make bananas the next year or the year after that. So this isn't like a pecan tree or a peach tree that goes on producing fruit year after year. The same clump of bananas will continue to produce bananas, but each plant is only going to make the one stalk, and they're never going to look like they did in South Africa, or they would in Jamaica, or, you know, places that have basically, you know, no hard freezing weather. But you will get a stalk of bananas. Most people, rather than leaving it on the plant indefinitely, oh, I had a girlfriend once from Florida, and they would cut the stalks of bananas and hang them in a dark place to let them ripen. And then, you know, they were small, tasty little bananas, but they're never going to look like the things that you get at the grocery store. We're just not in the right part of the world to do that. But there are a lot of different types of bananas. In all honesty, there are more ornamental bananas coming out, and some of them are absolutely gorgeous with dark, almost burgundy red leaves, some of them with big splotches in the leaves. But the old common green, kind of ugly banana palm is the one that's going to make the best fruit, if that's what you're wanting to do, is to actually grow a few of your own bananas.
Well, I love having them in the garden.
Uh-huh.
Whether they produce or they don't, but it was really a curiosity to know how we get the bananas. And are there many varieties then that are more productive of fruit?
I'm sure there are, Faye, but I don't know, you know, anyone that really is growing with the intent of producing much in the way of edible bananas. I don't know who you could ask. Maybe find a friend from Jamaica or somewhere where they grow a lot of bananas. Most of the ones that we deal with are the ones that are the beautiful foliage that people are growing more for the foliage than for the bananas. But just your common old green banana palm is certainly capable of producing bananas. And once again, we don't live in the tropics. We don't have year-round warm weather. So it's never going to be like a Caribbean banana, but they'll make interesting plants. But if you're looking for beautiful foliage, don't worry about the fruit. Get one of the Rojo bananas or one of the new Burgundy leaf bananas. They are absolutely gorgeous landscape plants, and they're not quite as cold hardy as the old common green banana. But if you mulch the base of them, even in the years that the top of the plant freezes back, they'll come back out the next spring. And Those little shoots that come up around the main plant grow just unbelievably fast. So if you take a few steps to be sure your plants get through the winter, you'll have your beautiful bananas for years, year after year.
Well, that's really good information. I sure appreciate it there. I had another question just as a reminder, because last year I just didn't get to garden very much. But on the Medina products, could you give me just a little rundown on what to use, what product to use for what purpose?
Well, I'll just hit the big three, so to speak. And there are two forms of the Has to Grow liquid fertilizer. There's Has to Grow Plant, Has to Grow Lawn. And as the name implies, the lawn is strictly for grass. The other is for just about everything else that grows, and it is a wonderful general-purpose fertilizer. The other liquid product that is widely used is the Has to Grow Soil Activator. That's what the company was built around. There's an improved form of it they call Medina Plus, but they still sell plenty of the old, you know, Medina Soil Activator as well. And it is mainly a microbial stimulant that serves to soften the soil and improve the quality of the soil, but it's not really a fertilizer. The third Medina product, which is very widely used, is their dry granular product. It's a dry granular fertilizer that's called Growing Green. And it's good for grass and trees and shrubs and ground covers and vegetable gardens and flower beds and just about everything that grows. It's not as fast released as the liquid fertilizers are, which means you don't use it as often. The dry fertilizer you use maybe 3 or 4 times a year. The liquid Has to Grow and liquid fish blend products, those you can use every couple of weeks. That's what I use in my greenhouse on my orchids and other things that I happen to be growing. But that just barely scratches the surface of all the good products that Medina makes or packages. Obviously, they don't make orange oil. They don't make molasses, but they seek out the very best sources of that and then package it and sell it. You can always go online to MedinaAg.com to see the full list of their products, but they have specialized products for pollution control. They have specialized products for the folks who are gardening on 1,000 acres instead of 1 acre. It's a big company with a lot of good things. But basically, the two Has to Grow fertilizers, the liquid fish blend fertilizer, the soil activator products, and then the dry granular fertilizers, those make up, I guess we'd say, the retail portion of most of what is sold. Now, again, they package molasses, they package liquid seaweed, they package orange oil. They have a lot of other products that have the Medina label on them.
Well, the other question I had is, when we look at our climate here versus somewhere Midwest where it also gets hot, is it just that we have a difference in the summers because we're longer hotter here than, say, Iowa?
It's hard, and I can't really begin to explain it. The intensity of the sun is just it seems higher here. I do and have traveled around the country, you know, for different reasons, meetings and things like that. And you go to South Florida and they grow impatiens in full sun. In Texas, if we put them out in the sun, they absolutely burn up if they're the old fashioned impatiens. And there are a lot of different factors come into play, and I'm honestly not enough of a meteorologist to tell you. In some cases, things don't grow as well because we don't have enough cold in the winter. In other cases, things don't grow as well because the heat is so intense. Plants have something called a compensation point, and that is how much energy it takes a plant just to stay alive. And any energy it has left over beyond that is what it's going to put into flowering and fruiting and making bananas or whatever else. But many times in our summer, the combination of the heat, the intense sunlight, humidity or lack of, the compensation point gets so high that the plants just don't, they're doing everything they can to just survive. They don't have much left over to flower and fruit and do the other things. So it's very definitely a combination of factors. And it's like anywhere else, you know, in the world. You mentioned your friend from Africa, there are certain plants like okra, which basically was developed, or it has always been a widely grown crop. There are plants that love the kind of weather that we have and others that just simply can't tolerate it. But by the same token, we can't grow peonies, we can't grow rhododendrons, we can't grow lilacs. But on the other hand, in California, they don't grow Texas mountain laurels or, you know, a lot of the other beautiful things we have. So it's just a matter of either learn to garden in the climate where you live or move to a more suitable climate if it's that important to you. But it's there are lots of different reasons that, you know, we don't have the same plants or the same gardens that you would see in Southern California or in Phoenix, for that matter. Just, You know, we make the most of what we have and focus on the things that do best for us and experiment with those other things just to see if we can make them grow.
Well, thank you. You've covered a lot of things I've been thinking about for a while.
Well, you get out and have a wonderful weekend, and I'll look forward to our next visit. Faye, thank you.
Thank you.
We'll talk again. Elaine, hang on just a second. I need to get a little break in here. Have the privilege of talking about Rhonda's Nature's Way. And I tell you about all the wonderful things I get from Rhonda, and other folks do as well. But I tell you, I'm talking to so many people right now that are suffering with oak pollen and all the allergies related to all the pollens out there. Do what I do. Get a product called Seasonal Allergy Relief. Now, if you suffer from cedar season is pretty much past now, but if you've got intense problems there, there's an even better one for cedar allergies, and it's called Cedar X. But if you've got issues with oak pollen and the molds and mildews and things that are in the air right now, try the Seasonal Allergy Relief. It works. It's totally not a pharmaceutical at all. It's an all-natural product, but it really, really works to keep you more comfortable. Gosh, I was looking the other day, was by visiting with Rhonda and picking up some different things. And she has all sorts of things. If you've decided you need to lose a few pounds, you don't have to give up flavor. You don't have to give, well, all you have to give up is sugar and the artificial sweeteners. And she's got things that are just absolutely wonderful on the palate, but will help you shed a few pounds and feel better at the same time. Once again, some of the supplements out there, I ask her for a supplement because I sometimes get leg cramps after I've been working extremely hard. Well, she had a product that I take morning and evening, and let me tell you, leg cramps are no more an issue. She carries the Neo 40 that I think is so good for your heart and vascular system. I can go on and on, but don't have the time to do it. If you want to live better naturally, well, and by the way, she does reflexology as well. I bought a gift certificate just this week for a friend for a reflexology session. So many reasons to go see Rhonda and her wonderful staff. They're open every day except Sundays and major holidays. I meant to ask her when I was out there a couple of days ago if they're going to be open. I believe they're going to be open Monday. Some places are going to close with the eclipse just because the traffic's going to be so bad, but best of my knowledge, Rhonda will be there 7 days a week until 6 days a week until the next major holiday. Just always closed on Sundays. Located out in the shopping center, the corner of I-10 and Callahan, kind of across the parking lot from Sprouts. You will love a visit. You will really, really increase your knowledge about your own health when you visit Rhonda's Nature's Way.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster is on the air. News Talk 550 KTSA and FM 107.1.
All right, let's get back to the phone lines. I do have some open lines. Grab one if you like. You know how it gets later in the show. It gets a little hard to get through. So remember that number, 210-599-5555. My next caller is Elaine. Good morning, Elaine.
Good morning.
Morning.
Bob, on a previous program, you were discussing controlling weed thatch. And you were talking about cutting it off at the ground level and using diesel.
Yep.
And I have a bunch of questions about doing that. Is it necessary to cut it off at the ground level? And are you using the diesel spraying on top of that to penetrate down into the plant? Or can you just spray it on the stem of it? Is it necessary to cut it off? And also, you said follow up with molasses. Are you using liquid molasses or dried molasses?
Okay.
And are you mixing the two? Or how are you doing this?
Well, again, diesel is nasty stuff. It's not organic. It's, to me, it's sort of a product of last resort. But there are some things that just come back so vigorously from the root system, unless you're willing to get out with a root plow and really work the soil, you know, a foot deep to get out most of the roots and things like that. Things like mesquite and weesetch tend to come back. And so Bruce Dooley did a fair amount of research early on. He found that if you do it very early in the season, when weesetch is first starting to come out, he used the diesel as a foliar spray and had good luck with just killing the plants entirely that way. Now, where I live up in the hill country, weesetch is not an issue. We're too cold most winters, but You know, I fight mesquite. I had an old uncle that thought it was really fun to take the mesquite beans and take them into from his yard in town and take them back out to feed the cows. Well, then the cows spread the seeds everywhere, so I fight mesquite just like a lot of other folks do. But if you cut things off at or near ground level, it takes away the capacity of the plant to store the sun's energy, so to speak. And it makes it much easier to kill the plant because, again, Wisatch mesquite, a lot of other things out there are strong that they, so strong that they can come back, you know, after being cut off at ground level. It just weakens it to the point that the diesel will do a better job of killing. Now, there's some very, what I consider very bad products out there that I hate to see people use. They are things that are tree killers, but they tend to move, most common one, by the way, is called Remedy, but they tend to move through the soil. They tend to kill a lot of things you didn't intend to kill. And the people that make that even recommend that you mix it with diesel to apply it because, I think, but my opinion is that the diesel is all you need. And the purpose of the molasses is to clean up the diesel. Molasses is a strong microbial stimulant. It has been used along with some of the Medina products worldwide in cleaning up toxic waste spills, cleaning up oil spills, things like that. So the purpose of the molasses is just to get rid of any residue from the diesel after it's done its job. Now, for the most part, hydrocarbons like diesel and just about all oils, when they break down, they actually turn into, you know, things that benefit plant growth. But while they are in their petroleum state, they, you know, they're pretty deadly to things like the.
So you're spraying that on top after you spray the diesel. You're putting it right on the place where you sprayed the diesel, the molasses.
I'm pouring it on rather than spraying it on.
Pouring it. Okay, yeah. You're just pouring. Yeah. Okay.
Like I say, experimented with using it as a foliar spray early in the season. And, you know, Google Bruce Dooley. He's doing a podcast. He's doing some things not on public radio like, you know, like you're listening to me. But he is still very active, and it would be very interesting to get his take on if he has continued to experiment with that. He doesn't live on the big acreage he once lived on. But I haven't had good luck applying it to foliage. I simply, like I say, I cut it off. And then we'll pour over the stump. It might be a cup. It might be a quart, depending on how big the stump I'm trying to kill is. I used to recommend mixing diesel and molasses together, but they don't mix well. You have to keep shaking. You have to keep stirring, you know, to keep keep the two. Yeah. So I've gone to just, you know, say, okay, use the diesel, come back a couple of weeks later after it's done its job and apply the molasses. But the molasses is simply cleaning up the little bit of pollution that you created by using the diesel.
Okay. So now I'm leasing a neighbor's pasture that has got Wisatch in it that are tree size. How do you tackle that? How do I get rid of that? I mean, it's going to be kind of hard to cut it off at the – okay, you're going to cut it off at the ground?
Yep. Good old chainsaw.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Is it okay once you cut it off, is it okay to just let it lay there, or do you have to move the cut off Wisatch away and put it on a burn pile or something? I mean,
no,
is it going to come up from the...
You don't have to do anything special with it. I love, you know, my partner and I bought a chipper for our two ranches years ago, and when we're cutting, again, we don't really fight Wisatch, but cedar is the big enemy, along with persimmon, along with mesquite. We just tend to run it through our chipper, which will handle things up to about 6 inches in diameter. If I wanted to do, how big a pasture are you leasing? How big an area is this?
It's about 5 acres.
Okay. If you have, you know, the help to do it, what I would do is I would cut, I would treat, and then I'd just rent a chipper for a day. You can go out and rent a chipper that'll handle up to 10-inch logs, and it's a day's work, let me tell you. It's
right.
I would call every friend you have and promise them plenty of good adult beverage after the work is done. But it's amazing, and There are other things, but I don't think they're really available, you know, to the general public right now. Now, don't get me started on this, but the government has decided to mess up a totally good flood control dam on my property, and what is totally unnecessary, in my opinion, and the county engineer's opinion. But they came in with an interesting little grinder that's mounted on the front end of a skid steer. And this thing just, I mean, they did drive up to a mesquite, and this thing starts spinning, and the whole tree just kind of goes down to ground level. It gets ground up. They've ground down into the soil. It's going to be interesting to see whether the area they're doing this, whether the things are going to come back or not. But the professionals have some interesting new equipment out there. But where I'm doing the work, I'm just going to cut it and run it through the chipper. There's nothing wrong with leaving it in place, but it will inhibit the growth a little bit of your pasture grass, and it's a nuisance just to deal with if you're running cattle or goats or whatever else on this 5 acres. But you just have to kind of do what fits your budget and, most importantly, the time you have to do it. I mean, I'm capable of doing almost anything, and if I could just get about 6 more hours in every day and 3 more days in every week, I might get caught up someday, but somehow that just doesn't seem to be happening.
Okay. Now, I have another question about, I have another plant I've noticed. I call it rosehedge. I don't know what the correct name is, but it's thorny and it's waxy leaves and it comes up. How do you get rid of that plant? Do you, can you use diesel on that too, or because of wax can, on the leaves? I mean, you, what do you, you do
can
with
use,
that?
You can use it, you know, again, drenching the soil. You can kill just almost anything with it. Now, I would
using
I
diesel. Would, using
yeah.
diesel.
Yeah.
Okay.
Uh-huh. I would get someone to help you identify things, because there's some thorny plants out there that really do have some benefit. There's one, for instance, it's the larval host for some of the most beautiful butterflies we have, but it is one thorny, nasty little thing. I cut it, you know, where it's anywhere that I'm going to encounter it, but I don't try to kill all of it because it's serving, you know, a very good purpose in nature. So just be sure what you're trying to kill. There are a lot of ugly plants out there that, you know, do have benefit in the environment, but I have yet to find anything very good about weasatch or mesquite.
Yeah, and what about poison ivy and poison oak? Can you spray that with diesel?
You can, but I actually prefer to use the vinegar and orange oil mix. You don't vinegar and orange oil leaves no residue in the soil. There's no cleanup afterwards. What I do, and I fight poison ivy like everybody else does, I will cut the vines off at ground level rather than try to spray the whole vine. And then when it tries to sprout out from the base, that's when I hit it with the vinegar and orange oil mix. Usually have to spray it 2 to 3 times, and then it dies completely.
Okay. All right. So vinegar for that poison ivy. Well, okay. Yeah. Well, and I have another weed, I think, coming up. And I call it a sage. It looks like a nut sage kind of in a way, but it comes up and it's got this center in it with kind of flowers. And I think it needs a lot of moisture, because I notice it more along the creek bottom where I have rather than where it's higher. And I was just wondering, well, is that something else that I could use diesel on to spray that?
Again, I would keep your, I would limit your diesel use to woody things that you're trying to kill, because you just don't need it for most of these other things. And, The sedges, for instance, you can pretty much eliminate those with molasses, just because it creates such a such an aerobic condition in the soil that your nut sedge and all the related sedges, they prefer a lousier soil. They prefer more anaerobic conditions. But the starting point is going to be to figure out what this plant is, but I suspect that once again, vinegar and orange oil is all you're going to need. You know, I'm not going to use my 30-06 to kill an ant, but so I'm not going to use, you know, anything any stronger than what I have to use. And very much limit my use to of anything that's not organic. And like I say, it's just, in some cases, it's a lesser of two evils. I don't like using the molasses, but the diesel, but it sure is better than Remedy and the other really toxic products out there. So always go after the problems with the least toxic solution you can. And there are very few things that you really, and many things you can just totally eliminate by changing the environment, your soils and things, to things that are more conducive to growing the plants you like. And the weedier, problematic things just, you know, don't compete well. So it's kind of like it's easier to stay healthy through the way you take care of your body than it is to try to get over some malady that you created by abusing yourself, so to speak. And your garden, your yard are the same way. The better care you take of it, the fewer problems you'll ever have to face. You've probably heard me talk about having a horrible problem with sticker burrs at one point. I simply put down a layer of compost over that at the appropriate time of the year, and I haven't had a sticker burr in that part of the yard in the 10 or 15 years since I did that. So I just, you know, I'll always use the least toxic material and don't target anything other than the plants you're trying to get rid of. And on, you know, specific plants, do just what you've done. Give me a call and we'll try to figure out what the best solution is to get rid of them.
Right. Well, that's very good. Well, I thank you for that information. And just a little side note, I used that azomite on some old crepe myrtles that my parents had planted on this land for maybe 50-something years ago. And for the first time, they are so green and beautiful. That is so nice.
It's
so
just
that azomite on hand.
Well, it is a wonderful product, and I just keep asking myself, gee, I wish I'd known about it. Why did I know about this 10 or 15 years ago? But you can't look backwards. You have to look forwards. And I'm just very thankful we have azomite available to us now, because it does, as you're discovering, it does an awful lot for plants young and old.
Is azomite similar to the growing green, or are they totally different?
Totally different. Azomite is a mineral ore, volcanic in origin, and, you know, a few million years ago when, you know, our place we live was covered with volcanoes, different minerals wound up mixing with the lava, and azomite is actually mined. I think it's in Nevada. It's either Arizona or Nevada. It's mined and, you know, ground into the appropriate size. Growing green and things like that are fertilizers that are, you know, it's natural products that man is combining. It's not synthetic nitrogen like what you get in the fertilizers we don't recommend, but it's companies like Medina and Maestro Grow and Nature's Creation that are taking various good nutrient products and putting them all together in one thing. It's kind of like getting a 7-course meal for you is more satisfying than just having one good filet. And the same way with the plants, it's great to mix, you know, several different natural beneficial products together and then apply them at one time instead of applying them separately. And that's what you're getting when you're dealing with a good fertilizer.
Okay. Well, excellent. Well, I just, you know, I was thrilled when I saw how they responded, because they just looked pretty bad for a long time. And I was taking them out, and I put that on, and I went, whoa, this is wonderful. So.
Well, use that more widely. Just don't put it on the things you're trying to get rid of.
Okay.
You get out and have a great weekend.
Thank you for this information. I will. Yes. Thank you so
My
much.
Pleasure.
Have a great day.
You're welcome.
Bye-bye.
You too. Bye. Henry and Karen, hang on. You guys are up next, but right now, looks like I get to talk about another great product out there, new to the market, veteran-owned company right up there in Boerne, Texas. And the company is called Aqualock. They make quite a number. In fact, if you go to aqualock.com, Google that, and you'll see a lot of different things they make. But the two things that I really like to talk about, number one is their product that is made to increase the water holding capacity of the soil. It's a material, colloidally based material that forms a substance that holds the moisture in the soil, great for use in hanging baskets, great for use in pots. Has to be blended into the soil. You can't just put it on the surface. But it's a product that naturally is going to break down over time. It takes about a year and a half for that to happen. But in the meantime, you'll find that you have to water a whole lot less, and it helps keep the water and the minerals in the soil without depleting the oxygen in the soil. And that is what they call TerraLock. Their other great product is called SuperCast, and it is some of the best quality worm casting materials you will ever find, combined with all sorts of other things that will enhance plant growth, and then a smaller amount of the TerraLock product mixed in to once again help with holding the moisture so that your plants can grow at their absolute peak. Two great products. You'll find them at nurseries throughout the area nowadays. The TerraLock, just to increase the water holding capacity, blended with the soil. The SuperCast, to blend with the soil, to help, well, just everything you're growing, but especially making a soil mix for hanging baskets, containers, raised beds, things like that. The SuperCast and the TerraLock, both great products from our friends at Aqualock up in Burney, Texas. Look for them at fine nurseries and garden centers everywhere.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster. News Talk 550 KTSA and FM 1071.
All right, back to gardening, and it's going to be Henry and Karen and Kathy. Henry's up first. Good morning, Henry.
Good morning, Bob. How are you?
I'm off to a good start. It's going to be a beautiful Saturday out there.
Yes, it looks like it is. Bob, I wanted to tell you what I was using. I'm using Has to Grow Plus, molasses, carrot juice, and fish. And I had talked to Stuart, and this is in a 16-gallon tank. I'm putting a pint, and really wasn't getting the growth that I wanted to really see. And he suggested to me to put in the Has to Grow Lawn and Humus. And let me tell you, Bob, that has kicked those plants in the butt, and they really look great.
Well, that doesn't really surprise me. I'll just tell you, be careful in doing it. You're really kicking up the available nitrogen, and for many plants, that works extremely well. In the early days of experimenting with things, I found that Has to Grow Lawn sprayed on your tomato plants accidentally is not real good for the tomato plants, but where you're applying it carefully, you're just applying more fast release nutrient material. And, yeah, I can see where it would give you, very good results, but just be careful not to use it on real tender plants, because it's just a little too strong for some things. The Hastro plant, I don't think you would ever burn anything with it, but personal experience tells me that Hastro lawn, unless you really know what you're doing, it's meant for grass and not for more tender things. So be careful with it, but boy, if it's working for you, just keep right on doing it.
Well, I'm only using a half a pint of the lawn and the humus, and yep. I'm not spraying it. I'm ground feeding it, and it's just amazing.
Well, what it does. And Medina makes both the liquid humates and the dry humate materials, and those are some of the best soil builders. They're not used as directly by the plants, but they enhance the capacity of the soil, the microbial life in the soil, and also the water holding capacity of the soil. And it's a great mix for a person who knows what they're doing and does it carefully. I'll just put it that way. It's not kitchen. Well, I guess it is kitchen chemistry, so to speak, but you've got it figured out, and it's working well for what you're growing, and that's a good thing.
Well, I just want to put it out there for people. If they're not seeing the results, it's just working great. And I know you've got a lot of people call from New Braunfels.
Yes.
Maldonado Nursery over on Zip Road.
Uh-huh.
I've known those folks for over 50 years, Bob, and there's some fine people over there. And Efren is one of the boys. His dad's passed away now. They have make their own compost, and they have probably right at a 5-6 acre nursery. And
yeah.
they have good-looking plants over there.
Well, they're a good company. I'll make it a point to get by and see them. I was through New Braunfels yesterday, but next time I get up that way, I'll go pay him a visit and tell him you recommended him.
Yes, sir.
Appreciate it.
And over at Producers Co-op, Bob, they have all the organic stuff there, too, if people are having problems finding it around here in your Braunfels.
Well, I appreciate you sharing that with us, and you get out and keep up the good work, and I'll look forward to our next visit, Henry. Guys, let me get my last break of the hour in here, and then we'll talk to Karen and Kathy. Looks like I get to talk about Medina, and that's such a pleasure. You know, the Medina Company's been around for, I guess, close to 60 years now. They built their business by helping farmers and ranchers, helping, you know, big agricultural producers improve their soil so that they got better results from their crops. That hasn't changed. Medina still helps farmers and ranchers who are working thousands of acres, but they also have that great line of products that are aimed for us homeowners and smaller scale operations. And, you know, you don't hear Stuart talk about it all the time, but still very involved worldwide in cleaning up pollution problems, cleaning up spills of toxic chemicals. And microbial technology is just, well, it's something that they're probably the best in the world at. And it's our great benefit that we get to buy and use their fine products. Again, we've talked a lot about their different liquid fertilizers, the Hasgrow products and the liquid fish blend, their soil softening products like the soil activator and the Medina Plus, all of the great things they package, like a wonderful liquid seaweed, the different humate products, the orange oil, simply the best in the industry. If you want to see the full list, simply go to MedinaAg.com. If you want to see those products that you and I can take advantage of in our smaller garden areas, just go to a good nursery or garden center that carries quality products. You'll find lots of wonderful things from Medina. Medina's getting out and doing a lot of different programs around this spring and summer as well. So check their website for complete information on that as well. MedinaAg.com.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster is on the air. News Talk 550 KTSA and FM 107.1.
All right, back to gardening. Just like I told you, the lines would get a little jammed up, so hang on a couple of minutes before you dial. We're going to talk to Karen and Kathy and Turkey Tom and Dave. Karen is first in line. Good morning, Karen.
Good morning, Bob.
Hey, good morning.
Good morning. I had some questions on finishing up my fall garden.
Okay.
And this is actually my first year of having really success. I'm excited. But last week I cut some of the coleslaw, the heads, and all of a sudden they're just making these huge heads. And I noticed it's getting not bitter, but a little bit spicy hot, you know, so I made coleslaw. Do I just cut them all maybe and put them in the refrigerator so they don't stay out in the heat anymore? Or
well, just watch your watering. Usually it's a combination of getting too dry along with the heat. Yeah, it's getting toward the end of the growing season. Looking at the next week's forecast, today and tomorrow are going to be pretty warm, but then we're going to be back to very moderate weather. So if you feel like they're still increasing in size and, you know, doing well, there's, I wouldn't say that, you know, it's mandatory to cut them yet. I think they're probably either not getting watered quite thoroughly enough or they're just getting a little too dry between waterings is why you're getting a little bit stronger flavor and a little bit more toughness to the texture.
That could be because I've been not real good on that. Okay, that's good. One of them is amazing. I planted two varieties. I don't remember. One of them was early Copenhagen, so I don't know which one is which. It's a cone shape. It's so cool looking. It's a big cone. It's just funny. But the other thing I was curious about, okay, so I had some broccoli, and I think it was a desicco or something like that maybe. And I think it said on the package it was kind of known for side shoots or whatever. And it did. I cut the top, and oh, my goodness, it had so many side shoots. And I learned something. My daughter and my niece said, told me those are called broccolinis. And sure enough, I know I saw them at the grocery store. I go, well, what do you know about that? But anyway, so I just kind of let it go, and it got covered in these beautiful yellow flowers, like pretty enough to put in the flower garden. And I just left it because there was honeybees and all of that.
Right.
So now it's making seed, and they look like this is all kind of a new experience for me. It's kind of, they look like little miniature green beans, like little pods everywhere.
Right.
So what I was wondering is, I really need the space to, for my summer. So to make them, I would imagine the pods have to go brown before the seeds are ripe. Can I, do I have to put them in the ground, or like pull them out and just let them dry? Or?
In all honesty, the seed is probably not going to come true. And in most cases, now if it's an heirloom tomato or something, you can save the seed that year after year after year. But at this point, those things, basically pull them up, throw them on the compost pile, and start fresh next year, because you'll find that most of the seed that's made on plants like that, the next year it will not be the same as what you started with. So it's certainly time to get a lot of warm weather things in the ground. And most of those things that have finished their productivity, and same thing's true of broccoli. It's great to leave it in the garden for the pollinators, but once it's not even blooming much anymore, it's the compost pile is the best place for it to be.
Okay. Yeah, I've planted my, like, my hills of squash and cantaloupes in between where the broccoli, because I'm like, should I pull it up? It just looks really, it's really cool to see those pods coming out of there.
Well, you do, if it's educational to you and family, you know, leave a few, but boy, don't neglect putting in your bush beans, your black-eyed peas, getting close to time to be planting okra. You know, not to mention peppers and tomatoes and eggplant. The garden's just never big enough at this time of year because there's so many different things
that's
you should be planting.
Yeah, that's the problem I'm having. Well, there was one other one that I'm not, I don't know how it grows, and I've second time I've tried it, it's the Brussels sprouts. Mm-hmm. I have the plants, and they almost look pretty. They're big and bushy, but they're low. So what's going to happen? I know they take longer, but is it too late? I mean, do they send up a stalk? Where do the Brussels sprouts come from?
They put up a central stalk, but if they take three times as long as broccoli or cabbage, and if they're not starting to produce those stalks, they will eventually, but when they do it in the heat, the little Brussels sprouts that form up and down the stalk tend to be much looser, not that tight little Brussels sprouts. Oh, man, I had some of the best Brussels sprouts yesterday. That's a whole other story, but you just have to get your Brussels sprouts in the ground early. They ought to go in, you know, maybe even August or September, so that you have time for them to produce. Planted late, they're going to grow. They're going to be interesting. I'd probably leave one or two just so you can see and learn from it. But chances of getting much in the way of edible Brussels sprouts this late in the season is getting pretty low.
Okay. Yeah, last year I put all three of those things in about the beginning of October. Mm-hmm. So the Brussels sprouts should have went in earlier. Right.
They should have, should have gone in a couple of months earlier.
Okay. Well, that's good. That's all. It's a learning, because I'm not really good on the fall things, you know, but that's great. So thanks for your help on that.
Always a pleasure, Karen. You get out and have a wonderful weekend. And let's get Kathy in here before the news break. Good morning, Kathy.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I'll try to make this quick. I have a magnolia tree. We've lived in this house 3 years.
Okay.
And the house is 16 years old, so I don't know when it was planted. I live in the sand in Lavernia. A beautiful magnolia tree for 2 years. Last year, outstanding. It just was gorgeous. This year, the two very small bottom limbs are dead. And I have very few leaves. It's not reproducing leaves, but it's loaded in the buds.
Uh-huh.
So I'm confused.
Well, it's many times when plants are severely stressed, they flower extra heavily. It's not to please you. It's just their effort to make seed and reproduce. So you want to reduce the stress. Magnolias want cool soil. The happiest magnolia will be one that has 2 or 3 or 4 inches of mulch over the root zone. Once again, you're in an area where you've got great drainage, so you need to probably be watering more frequently. Now, it will benefit from some azomite. It will benefit from some good fertilizer. Probably the fastest acting would be one of the liquid, either the has-to-grow product, has-to-grow plant, or the liquid fish blend. But your magnolia got really stressed in the heat, and then followed by that little bit of severe cold we had this year. But what I would do is I would mulch it heavily, feed it regularly, water it deeply whenever that soil's dry, about an inch deep, and chances are it'll take a couple of years to look good again, but it will.
Okay. Okay. Well, I was beginning to panic.
Well, again, magnolias are tough to grow in this part of Texas. Now, you go over to East Texas, you go over to Mississippi and Alabama, they're one of the most beautiful trees you'll ever see. But they take a little bit of special attention. You don't, now obviously these limbs that died, go ahead and cut those off. But in general, we let the magnolias make foliage all the way down toward the ground, because they like that foliage to keep the soil cooler, to keep the root zone cooler. What you can do is compensate for the loss of those with 2 or 3 inches of mulch over the surface of the soil. Listen, if you have other questions, I'll get Greg to put you on hold, and we'll talk after the newscast. Everybody else, stay right there. We'll be back after the news here on KTSA San Antonio.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster is on the air. Talk to Bob now, 210-599-5555.
Yeah, but don't dial right this second, because all four lines are taken. We will have a line available for you very shortly. You're going to visit a little bit more with Kathy and then Turkey Tom and David James. So back to those phone lines. Let's keep going, Kathy.
Okay, a question more on the magnolia tree. I do have mulch under it. How large an area under it should that be?
It should be as wide as the extent of the branches out to the drip line, and even a little bit beyond that if you can. Most trees, their root zone actually goes out about 50% beyond the drip line. So with a magnolia, anything that's in the shadow of the top, mulch it heavily. If you can go a little bit further, all the better.
Okay. And should it be pulled away from the trunk itself?
Yes, you should always have good air circulation around the trunk, but just pull it back just far enough to, that you've got free air movement, and your magnolia will love you for it.
Okay, great. Now, we also have several large oak trees on our property, and we have Bermuda grass, but, of course, we can't get anything to grow under those oak trees.
Right.
Suggestions.
Well, there are ground covers like Asian jasmine that will grow underneath there. There are many different beautiful plants, from holly fern to giant liriope to native plants like Turk's cap and columbine and American beautyberry. You can, either create basically additional beds, or you can just plant a good ground cover and be done with it. You could grow, if you just wanted something that looked like grass, you could plant dwarf monkey grass. If you want a very fast-growing ground cover, although it does have a couple of problems of its own, but the plant that is called Vinca major or Vinca minor, there's also a variegated Vinca, in fact, more than one variegated Vinca's form of variegated Vinca. Those are fast-growing, fairly dense ground covers. Now, I know some folks worry about snakes and things like that, but ground cover would be, a possibility. Just simply covering the soil with a good mulch is another possibility. But if you wanted to create some beds around there, they're wonderful perennials. They're beautiful annuals, and there are shade-tolerant evergreens that, could make it, you could grow very well underneath there and be a real landscape enhancement.
Okay, especially for the backyard, we would like to make a sitting area underneath there.
Right.
And so, will the ground cover work with that?
Well, you probably want to put stepping stones in there so that you're not just trampling it, getting back and forth of those lounging areas, but I think it's a great thing to do. It reduces the number of plants you have to plant, gives you a nice hard surface to walk on, and a beautiful spot in the shade.
Okay, all righty. Okay, one last question. Can we use the ash from our fireplace as fertilizer?
It is a very small amount of it can be good. It's very high in potassium, but most of the soils already have enough potassium, and it is very, very alkaline. So just a very light application of ash is fine, but it's not It's the only element that it really contains is potassium, and you really don't need a whole lot of that, so don't get carried away with it.
Okay. All right. Well, if it doesn't get cold, we wouldn't have to worry about that. So,
amen to that.
Well, I appreciate it so much. We listen to you and really need your help with things, so thank you.
Well, it's my pleasure to be here for you. And next in line is Kathy. Good morning, Kathy. Okay, I'm sorry. Our next caller is going to be Turkey Tom. That's right. Okay, good morning. Hey, good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Bob.
What's going on this beautiful day?
I found out, apparently, my great-grandfather was known for his grafting ability and his weird attempts at grafting strange things. And apparently, the story goes that he managed to graft peach tree branches onto a mesquite tree and actually get a fairly good amount of peaches off a mesquite tree. And I was wondering, is that even possible? Is this some kind of old wives' tale that's been passed down, or... can you graft a peach tree onto a mesquite tree?
I've never heard of it. Doesn't mean it's not possible. And what is a quote I saw just this last week from one of the great abstract painters said, if you can imagine it, it's real. And I've never heard of anyone doing that, but I'm not going to say that your granddad might not have been able to do it, but I tell you what, and one of the things I'm going to talk about when I do their spot for them, Fanix Nursery over in Southeast San Antonio, they're having a grafting seminar today free of charge. If you want to go over and learn all about grafting, you might go over and talk to their folks, but I've never heard of grafting a peach to a mesquite.
All right. Well, maybe one day I'll give it a shot, and if it works, I'll let you know. But
well, listen,
I don't know.
Yeah, it's it would be a wonderful thing, but I kind of doubt it. The vascular system of many woody plants just varies from plant to plant, and things just don't graft well together. But anyway, 9 to noon, they're having their grafting seminar over there, and that would be a good question to ask somebody there. But I've never heard of that being successful.
All right. I've also come across some blackberries in the store. They're called... Sweet Caroline blackberries, and I can't find plants for those anywhere. Could I take some of those blackberries and start them from seed? And what's the best way to start a blackberry from seed?
Yeah, blackberries aren't usually grown from seed. I doubt that the seed would be viable. Blackberry plants, tend to make little underground runners, and they produce new plantlets all around them. I would probably get on the good old internet and see if you can locate the plants, and just be careful. Don't get carried away, because just because it's in the store and just because it tastes delicious doesn't necessarily mean it would grow here. About 5 years ago, some folks, some very good folks, started hearing about a new blackberry that would grow 6 feet tall and produce extremely heavily and make really, really good berries. And, well, it turned out that it would do that for about a year and then it would fold up and die just because it wasn't happy with their climate. It was something that was developed for a more northern climate. So it's about the only way that you could, be sure of getting it there. There's nothing wrong with getting a plant and then propagating it either through cuttings or letting it make the plantlets around the base. The patent laws are not well understood by many gardeners, and you'll always see notes on the tags on plants that are patented. This may very well be a patented variety that says plant propagation prohibited. Well, that's not entirely true. You can propagate as much as you want for your own use. You just can't, put it out on the market for sale. So do some research. See if you can find out where the plants are grown, where they're available. But it's hard. I don't think it's possible to have too many good blackberries. And I'd love to know a new variety, because my favorite, Roseboro, seems to be getting harder to find. But I've not seen that. The other thing you could do, the two guys that keep up with new introductions better than anybody I know are Mark and Mike Fanick over at Fanick's Nursery. And give them a call over there probably on a weekday when they're not so busy and ask either Mark or Mike if they've ever heard of or seen that variety of blackberry.
Okay, that sounds like good advice. Yeah, I've got a bunch of varieties here growing, but none of them taste as good as the one I bought at the store. And man, if I could, I'd pull all those out and start over if I could get that.
And just remember that even if it is a really, really good variety, it has to grow in the right environment to produce that quality of berry. And it's not just the name that makes it taste good. It's being grown in the area where it grows best. And I'm not going to say unfortunately, because I'm kind of glad we don't have a lot in common with California, but they do have some regions where their climate is just far, far, far better than Texas. And, you know, with things getting around this globe so easily, I'm surprised how much of our produce is actually grown in New Zealand and shipped to this country. So that may not even be something that was grown in the good old United States. But do some research. I'd love to hear back from you what you find out.
Yes, sir. I'll look around. And one last question. I know you talk bad about synthetic fertilizer and all that, and I don't really use that stuff, but is high nitrogen organic fertilizer okay to use? What's the difference between that and, say, a synthetic?
That is an excellent question. And so let's try to cram a short college course into a couple of minutes here. The big two disadvantages to synthetic fertilizers are, number one, they bring no energy, and no matter what the source of nutrient, the material has to be processed by microbes in the soil to be made available to the plants. And those microbes have to have an energy source, which is the organic material that's in the soil. When you're using straight synthetic fertilizers, which bring no energy along with them, you are depleting the soil. The microbes are breaking down and using up the organic material in the soil. And so your soil is getting worse and worse and worse and worse. Whereas with organic fertilizers, they tend to bring more energy to the soil than they take away, so they actually build the soil. The second bad thing about so many synthetic fertilizers is that they are highly water soluble. If you want to look up all the reasons for that, it involves the two different states, something that's in a cation form, which means it has a positive charge to it. Binds to the soil and binds to different things in the soil. Your synthetic fertilizers tend to have the majority of their nutrients in what we call the anion form, which is highly soluble, and up to 80% of the fertilizer actually goes into solution, not only washes away, but causes severe pollution problems when it gets into the streams and waterways, basically because it causes an overgrowth of algae and some other things in there. So, synthetic fertilizers, they tend to deplete the soil of its organic material, and they tend to pollute because they're highly water soluble. And but organic fertilizers, organic nitrogen, is used on a limited basis. Again, you all have to look and see what the chemical nature of that is. I know there are some nitrates come out of Chile that are naturally occurring. But once again, they don't have a lot of, they're not bringing a lot of organic material to the soil, not bringing a whole lot of life to the soil. So even those I wouldn't overuse, but certainly better than the synthetic nitrogen fertilizers.
Okay, so it sounds like you can use the organic high nitrogen, just use it in moderation.
Exactly. All things in moderation. Okay.
That makes a lot of sense. And so is there an advantage over a higher nitrogen organic versus a lower nitrogen organic?
Not really. It's probably going to give you faster growth, but faster growth sometimes is a little more succulent, is not as tough and durable. It's very definitely more prone to insect issues than things that grow a little bit more slowly. And once again, you'd be applying it don't overdo it beyond a certain point. When things are in the cation state, if you have enough lava sand, if you have enough organic material in the soil to sequester it, that is to hold on to the nitrogen until the plants are ready to use it, that's a good thing. But it's also possible to just overload your soils with more material than the then the soil microbes can really bind and hold in place, if that makes sense.
All right. It sure does. Thank you for your time, Bob.
And as always, I like even the best products out there. I like sometimes combining them, blending them together, putting them in sort of a rotation. I really like most of the products that Medina makes, along with Nature's Creation, along with Maestro Grow and some of the others. But of the Medina products, I've used Has to Grow Plant for years, but since I started alternating that with the Has to Grow Liquid Fish Blend, I've gotten even better growth because it's just kind of a varied diet. I don't believe in sticking with exactly the same thing all the time, but probably the most important thing I can tell you is take good notes and keep up with what you're using, how often you're using it. So when you have real success, you can repeat it. And when you have that occasional failure, you won't go back and make the same mistake a second time, if that makes any sense. Because so many people, like, already had a caller this morning who was saying she planted things, but she didn't remember what variety it was. Just what I do, have that little rural mailbox out there in the garden, keep a little notebook in there, and just make notes of what you're doing so you don't have to remember it, and it'll really pay off for you long term.
Yes, sir. I keep track of weather. I keep track of chilling hours. I keep track of varieties, when I fertilize, everything. So when I mess something up, I can go back and look at it, and then I make a note not to do it again. And the problem is remembering to read through my notes from the year before. But I'm going to be
watching for Turkey Tom's Almanac to go along with the Old Farmer's Almanac. And you keep up the good work, and we'll talk again.
I appreciate it, Bob. Have a good morning.
You too. Thank you, sir. All right, let's get a break in here, and then we will get back to phone calls. Looks like I get to talk to you about Nature's Creation. Speaking of another great company, producing lots of good things, and they make good compost, different soils. They package that wonderful, what they call fungicide cornmeal that has little garlic in it that works to combat so many toxic fungus problems. But this morning they wanted me to focus on what they call their total weed and grass killer. Now, once again, it's just a combination. Well, it's basically a good, strong vinegar solution, non-selective. It's going to kill pretty much everything you put it on when it comes to weeds and grasses. But does a good job, is broken down in the soil, doesn't really move through the soil, so it's only going to kill the vegetation that it is sprayed on. You can get this great stuff wherever you find fine gardening products, but it's called the Total Weed and Grass Control, basically based on a strong 20% vinegar, and it really does work. In fact, the hotter it gets, the better it works. That, along with all sorts of other fine products from Nature's Creation, oh, golly, you're going to find it Friendly Natives up in Fredericksburg, Plant House, both in New Braunfels and in Kerrville. You're going to find it both Rainbow locations here in San Antonio, Milburgers, Fanix, and, of course, here at Shades of Green. We keep it, and many other fine products from our friends at Nature's Creation.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster. News Talk 550 KTSA and FM 107.1.
All right, back to gardening and back to the phone lines. Dave, James, Kit, and Tana. Dave's first. Good morning, Dave.
Good morning, Bob.
Good morning.
We went shopping for mulch yesterday. To what extent do you believe a cedar mulch is insect and weed suppressant?
Well, all mulches are weed suppressing, at least to some extent. Cedar contains some aromatic oils that are repellent not only to, you know, a lot of insects, but even to reptiles. For people that are, you know, that are afraid of snakes, there's some cedar oil products that work very well. Now, it is a total myth that cedar products contain something that retards plant growth. That is, that's a very commonly held belief, which is totally inaccurate. But cedar mulch is good stuff if you're looking for something that stays as a mulch because it doesn't break down quickly. And, you know, it very definitely will be weed suppressing. And the fresher it is, the more insect repellency, you know, it will have, because the oils are volatile. They do eventually go away, but there's nothing wrong with cedar mulch in any way. Now, it's not going to have the diversity of microbial life that a blended mulch made from a lot of different feedstock, so to speak, is going to have. But as a good mulch for its other purposes, like weed suppression, like keeping the soil cool, like retarding erosion, all those things, cedar mulch is absolutely ideal. And I think the biggest producers of it are probably this company called GeoSource. And they have some of it that's really fully broken down, which is approaching the point of being compost, but they also have some great mulch products. I've been told that their material is a little on the expensive side, but it's also top quality.
Who sells it around here?
You go directly to GeoSource. They're up on Highway 3351 just north of Bergheim. And, boy, they've got quite an operation up there. I'm not sure if they have any outlets around. You could always call them and ask.
Okay. I've got a pretty small area where I want to put a mulch down, and I'm going to be walking on it. So I'm thinking maybe cedar would be good there.
Oh, cedar would be good there. And if you just need a small quantity, Dave, go to get Nature's Creations product they call Cedar Repel, which is just a good bagged cedar mulch product. And if you just need a small amount of it, that's going to be, you're going to save a lot of gas money. If you need a pickup truck or a trailer load or a semi load, I'd very definitely consider GeoSource. But for just a small area, no, just go to a good nursery and you can get their Cedar Repel product, which is just a good cedar mulch.
Okay. It's probably more than a bag. I'd probably need a pickup. But then for a larger area with flower beds and stuff.
Uh-huh.
Thomas Stone had a hardwood compost blend, which is probably decent for that.
Oh, I'm sure. Yeah, and Bill does a good job. Thomas Stone is one of the better places around to get not only mulches and things, but also grass.
Do you have a preference in Palmetto or Del Mar?
Whichever you can find. I think the benefits are pretty much identical. Typically, Palmetto is a little easier to find, but I'd be happy with either one.
And they'll tolerate some sun, I'm assuming.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, if you water and fertilize, they're not going to be quite as tough as if it gets to 110 degrees as Floritam will, but it's a very sun tolerant grass.
All right, sir. Thank you very much.
Always good to hear from you. Have a wonderful weekend, Dave. And next in line is James. Good morning, James.
Morning, Bob. How you doing?
Oh, I'm doing well. How are you, sir?
Getting ready to get started this morning. Got to fertilize a few things.
It's going to be a good day to be out doing it.
Yes, sir. Bob, I've got a question about onions.
Okay.
We got a box of those Vidalia transplants from Dixondale.
Right.
And grew them with some high nitrogen organic fertilizer we got from Medina.
Uh-huh.
Did a real good job of growing them. And they're starting to bulb and get pretty big. The question is, what is the water management for onion bulbing?
Well, again, water doesn't hurt anything, but if anything stays so wet that the water drives the oxygen out of the soil, that's what is detrimental to the plants. It's not, too much water doesn't hurt a plant in any way. It's just if you get so much that it's, depleting the oxygen in the soil, you're growing in a good soil mix. And again, I would just do what I think you already do. When you water really thoroughly, let that soil dry to the appropriate point and water really thoroughly again. And, if you keep it on the dry side, any onion is going to be a little bit hotter in flavor. And if you, keep it a little more moist, it's going to be a little bit sweeter. Now, nothing's going to come close to the Texas Super Sweet for yellow onion, but Vidalias are good. Just, water management, just water thoroughly when you water and let it get dry an inch deep and water thoroughly again.
So a lot of the growers say you shouldn't water at all during bulbing, and I hear that from growers.
I think you probably know as much about growing onions as most any grower out there does. You'll get a little bit bigger onion with a little bit more moisture. And like I say, you'll get a little bit milder onion. I think the people that say don't water at all while they're bulbing live in a little bit less harsh climate than you and I do in South Texas. And there's certainly, you know, you never want to let any plant, onion or otherwise, stay too dry. And but I, you know, keep your records and see what you think. I would not treat the Vidalias any differently than I would the other onions that you grow and grow well.
Okay, that's good news. We got trichogrammas to put out today.
Uh-huh.
Are you familiar with the new release that we use for the trichogrammas? We put the little tabs in a wedge cup, little paper wedge cup, and then we fold over the top and staple it. Give them a couple of days to start swarming inside the cup. And then poke a hole through that cup with a sewing needle and then staple it to a leaf. And that will keep the fire ants from getting on the card and getting all the trichos off of there.
Yeah, it sounds like a good plan. I just have to be really careful that you don't keep them in too much sun when you seal them up like that. But the additional warmth will certainly get the little larvae developing more quickly. There's no doubt about that, but I think that's fine in the spring. I think in the summer I might be a little reluctant to slow down the air movement too much, but there's nothing at all wrong with what you're talking about. Sounds like a good way to do it.
Yeah, put them in the hoop house and in the shade, and you're in pretty good shape. And that Arbico outfit I've been doing business with, I found out they've got assassin bugs for sale.
Oh, really?
And I really want to, I really want to try some this year in a few enclosed areas. They're supposed to stay put where you hatch them, and they can take temperatures from 55 to 110 degrees.
Uh-huh. Well, they're wonderful
things.
That's a good thing. Yeah, just be aware that that long proboscis, if they feel threatened by you, they will skewer you with that, and it's not especially comfortable. They're not nearly as benign as some other things, but even a ladybug will bite you, as you've probably discovered. But enjoy watching your assassin bugs, but don't get too carried away with letting them walk over your hands or things, or you may get a rather painful pierce every now and then.
We're going to use them in the chili house. It's the shade house. And then I guess we can call them assassin chilies.
I'll let you work that one out. Sounds like a good plan, though.
Okay, thanks, Bob.
Thank you, James. We'll talk again, I'm sure. All right, let me get a break in here. Kit will be next, and then Tana. Right now, it looks like I get to talk to you about Wild Birds Unlimited. And, you know, I enjoy talking about Wild Birds Unlimited and all the fun things they have. Well, what they have as of yesterday is a second location. They've opened up on the far north end of Burney. So those of you guys who are driving into town to go to Wild Birds Unlimited, you go way out north on North Main Street, and they're out there. Now, I'm not real familiar. There's a brew pub out there, I believe, called 24 Songs or something like that. But they're out on the north end of Burney, and they have all the same great things that they have here in San Antonio. Probably be a little less crowded, too. As you're headed out on North Main, look for Market Street. In fact, that's where we used to actually have our Calgary headquarters years ago. They're right there. And, oh, golly, they've just got the same things that you're used to. The proper seed blends for the time of year, some of the best feeders, many of them with lifetime guarantees, all sorts of nesting boxes, and a lot of gift merchandise. They always have something new and unique. So you're going to find them to be pretty much like that location we've talked about for years. It's out there in the shopping center at the corner of Northwest Military and Huebner. You just, if you're way up north, Third Comfort or North Bernie or wherever, you're not going to have to drive all the way in town to find them. I'll let you give them a call to get their exact hours and days. I'll get that information before next week. But they're brand new up there, just opened yesterday, and you can be real sure that they would love a visit. So get by and see them and enjoy all the Wild Birds Unlimited products you've always enjoyed right in your own backyard. Wild Birds Unlimited, now with two locations to serve you.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster is on the air. News Talk 550 KTSA and FM 1071.
All right, back to gardening and back to the phone lines. It's going to be Kit, Tana, Barbara, and Ron. Kit is first in line. Good morning, Kit.
Good morning, Bob. Beautiful day to get outside.
It certainly is.
Hey, two quick fruit tree related questions. So I have an avocado that I got towards the end of last fall. I kept it in the hothouse over the winter, but the tops of it were completely brown, even though all the other citrus that was with it came through just fine. I'm finally starting to see buds in the lower part of the tree where it was green or remained green. Can I cut off the top of the tree where it's brown and hopefully force the nutrients and everything to stay in the green area, or what's the best approach?
Well, you're not going to force anything to stay down by cutting the top off. If the tissue's dead, it's not going to translocate the materials up there. I wouldn't be in a rush to do it. The only real reason to cut off that top is, cosmetic. So I probably would give it another month just to see if it is going to leaf out. This is roughly the 1st of April. If it's not leafed out by Mother's Day, yes, I would cut off anything that hasn't come out. But if the top is or if the bottom is coming out well, just be sure that that you're cutting off any growth that would be below the graft point. But you may wind up with more of an avocado bush as opposed to a real avocado tree. But that's going to be more productive anyway.
Yeah, I'd rather have a bush than a tree anyway, so that's good.
Well, in that case, go ahead and cut off the top anytime you like.
Okay. And then a similar question for a fruit tree. I have a more mature fruit tree. It's probably 6 or 7 years old and has multiple branches coming off. And there's one quarter of the tree that is greening out, hasn't produced any flowers yet like most of the other peach trees, but it at least is greening out. But the other, three-fourths of the tree, I haven't seen any buds, any swelling or anything like that. What is the best thing to do with that peach tree?
For the time being, I would be patient with it. We're seeing weird things like that on shade trees as well as fruit trees. And quite frankly, you may have a portion of the tree that for whatever reason just decided to die. The combination of the super dry summer, super hot summer, then followed by some extremely cold temperatures back in January, there are trees that normally would have been totally cold hardy that, big portions of the top of them have just died out. And I don't know how we could have prevented it, probably with better watering last summer, but at this point it's just going to kind of be wait and see. And, again, by early summer, anything that hasn't leafed out, we probably should prune. You may want to do a little bit more pruning later in the season to try to get that tree to a little bit better shape again rather than being totally top heavy on one side. But I would say this almost certainly weather related, but I'm beyond trying to explain some of the weird things we're seeing.
Okay. And then a quick switch to some vegetables. So, are the overnight lows getting warm enough now that the peppers and the tomatoes can go out in the ground, or is it still too chilly?
Oh, I think it's fine to put them out in the ground. The overnight loaves may keep some of them from setting much fruit, but the soil temperature is warming up nicely, which is going to make for strong roots, and strong roots make for strong plants. So I would not hesitate to put them in the ground, but again, you may see a slight delay in fruit production, but I think it would be more than offset by the better root growth you're going to have if you do go ahead and put them outside.
And then what is it you put underneath the tomato plants when you put them in the holes in the ground?
Rock phosphate. Powdered rock phosphate, and you put a layer of it in there so that the plant will form or will put its roots down directly through it. If you blend it into the soil, it's going to get tied up in a form the plants can absorb and use. But just by putting that layer of it down and then putting the, planting your plant on top of it, you pretty much double the pounds of tomatoes you're going to get.
All right. That sounds good. And that's only for tomatoes, right? You don't put it in for peppers or squash or anything like
that. You can use it anywhere. The results are most dramatic on tomatoes, but I think it's still a benefit to peppers and eggplant. It's just if you want to go to a little extra trouble or not, you will definitely see a change in your tomatoes. You may or may not see a significant increase in the others.
All right. That sounds great, Paul. That's all I have this morning.
Well, I appreciate the call. Then you get out and have a great weekend. And, Tana, guys, hang on just a second. Let me get my last break of the hour in here, and then we'll have a little time to talk before we do our segment with Howard Garrett. Right now, get to talk about Fanix Nursery and Garden Center. And as I mentioned earlier, they're having their grafting seminar this morning. It goes from 9 until noon over at the nursery, absolutely free of charge, but I would suggest that you get over there pretty early to get a good seat. They're also, the guys from the Rose Society are going to be there between 10 and 2 answering all sorts of questions. And, you know, as always, Fanix is well, well stocked on roses at this time of the year. They also have trees, you know, they have fruit trees, they have nut trees, they have citrus trees, and they have shade trees. And remember that green shade rebate program that CPS Energy does? That ends the end of April. So if you're planning on saving $50 per tree, be a great time to get over and get some of the qualifying trees and find out all about that program. I could go on and on. They've got a great selection of vegetables over there. They've got everything you're looking for in the way of organic products. They've got some new Ego lithium-ion battery-powered outdoor equipment. It's just always a good day to go visit Fanix. Over on Home Green Road, where they've been for 85 years now, they're going to have a big celebration coming up in June to celebrate their 85th anniversary. In the meantime, just get out and see them. Check out the website, too, Fanick Nursery. That's F-A-N-I-C-K, FanickNursery.com.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster. News Talk 550 KTSA and FM 107.1.
All right, back to the phone lines real quickly. Next in line is going to be Tana. Good morning, Tana.
Hey, good morning, fella.
Good morning.
As I mentioned, I now have an area in the west-southwest portion that I have access to water now. So I'm
very good.
Planting again. So far out there, I have a Celeste fig and a crepe myrtle. And in planters, I have zinnias, nasturtiums, green beans, and squash. Now, then, I have an area where the chinkapin oak heavily, heavily shades an area. Mm-hmm. What can I plant there that is a shrub or a tree?
Okay. And no hot sun at all?
No, just morning sun.
Okay. Well, if you're looking for green plants starting from the ground up, a couple of things that would be good. Holly fern would be beautiful in that kind of area. Giant liriope would do very well in an area like that. As we move up a little higher, if you're looking for a true shrub, Goldust Akuba would be a good plant that would grow. I mean, the ones on the front of our building have been here for 42 years that we've been here, and they're still going strong. Those are all very shade-tolerant. A couple of native plants that will do well, as long as it's not just total shade, but Turk's Cap is very happy somewhere like that. American Beautyberry would do fine. Those are a few good suggestions for you.
Okay. And because of that triple whammy that we got, the bur oak simply didn't make it.
Uh-huh.
Even with water that I was able to give it last summer, it still didn't. So what can I plant? No, is there a vine that, preferably flowering, but otherwise, that I can plant on the dead tree?
Sure, you could plant Tangerine Beauty Crossvine would be a good choice and would be very, very hardy. That's going to be one of the best, but you're also, where you are, you could probably grow true wisteria, not the so-called evergreen wisteria, although that's still another option, but true wisteria or Tangerine Beauty Crossvine would be two of the fastest growing, hardiest plants that are going to give you beautiful and fragrant flowers.
That Tangerine Beauty sounds just the ticket for me.
Well, it's a beautiful plant and much more hardy than some of the other things.
And it will adhere itself to the tree.
It doesn't attach itself, but it will wind around. It forms little tendrils that tend to, you know, wrap through the bark. I mean, it'll grow up the grow up the wooden side of our building, you know, finding a way to hang on to the siding. So it's not like English ivy or fig ivy that actually makes a little something that attaches directly to the tree, but it will grow up. It will find a way to hang on.
I thank you very much. This is a whole brand new area for me, and as you can tell, I'm really into it. So because of you,
well,
I
have
no idea what I can do.
It'll be a good learning experience. You'll have fun with it, and I'll look forward to talking with you about it in the future. And let's keep going here. Barbara is next in line. Good morning, Barbara.
Good morning. I have a couple questions. First one is about fire ants. I have the fire ants have invaded my vegetable garden along a raised bed, probably 8 feet long. I came down and got some of your mound drench, and I used that twice. They kind of moved around a little. What happened is I could see, when I really looked more closely, what was happening. There are a million little white eggs that they're moving. Then I came and got some beneficial nematodes, and I haven't used it yet. So I'm wanting to know, what order do I use these now to get rid of these? Do I put the nematodes down and then wait, or what?
You don't want to put the mound drench on top of the beneficial nematodes. You can do one and wait a while. The nematodes will be a little slower acting, but they'll be a little bit more complete in controlling the fire ants. What I would tell you is, on an ongoing basis, once or twice a year, put out some dry molasses. It doesn't kill the fire ants, but they don't like the microbial activity it creates. And most people that put out a little dry molasses periodically, the fire ants just simply go away.
Okay, so I could put the nematodes out and hope eventually it will take care of the whole thing, you think?
Oh, yeah, it certainly would, but it'll be a little slow in doing it. But because, you know, the big fire ant mound can have over a million ants in it, and it takes a little while for the nematodes to get them all.
Okay, I'll do that. One more question. I have an area between us and the neighbors that I had years ago, 30 years ago, we put in, wish we hadn't, you know, the red tip photinas in the bitter.
Right.
They're taking turns dying now. And I want something. It's an area where we have deer. Of course, it's full sun, but I want something to plant along there that will go up probably 8 or 10 feet. I thought you said one time, maybe I'm thinking of something else, you said a bay laurel or something like that.
And where are you located?
Boulevardy.
Okay.
I want
bay laurel. Yeah, bay laurel is a wonderful plant. Mine in Burney has frozen down a couple of times in the past 3 years, but it continues to come out, and it's a great plant. It is very definitely, you know, deer resistant, evergreen, and if you like cooking with bay, you'll never have to buy another bottle of bay leaves at HEB again. Mountain laurels are deer resistant, and they grow moderately quickly, you know, with good care, and they will certainly get up to that height. plant that's not going to get quite that tall, but another excellent plant is a type of viburnum called Viburnum suspensum, also known as Sandanqua, S-A-N-D-W-A-N-K-A or something like that. But Sandanqua viburnum is very, very deer resistant. Those are going to be some of your best choices. Some of the bigger hollies, too, like Nellie Stevens or Foster's, if you just overrun with deer, they may nibble on them, but in general, they will leave them alone. Barbara, tell you we can talk more after the Howard Garrett segment if you want to call back. Same thing with you, Ron. Right now it's news time on KTSA San Antonio, Texas.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster is on the air. Talk to Bob now. 210-599-5555.
But don't cut right this minute. If you've been listening long, you know that this is the time on Saturday mornings that we enjoy a visit with Mr. Howard Garrett, the Dirt Doctor. Good morning, Howard.
Good morning, and how is everyone?
Well, we are enjoying a beautiful spring day down here, and still it's, oh golly, there are just weird things happening out in nature this year, but it sure looks like next week or so is going to be beautiful. Everybody's a little concerned about whether or not it's going to be cloudy on Monday for the big eclipse, but not a darn thing we can do about it, so we're going to enjoy it, whatever.
Yeah, it sounds like it's not too good a chance that we're going to get to see it. It sounds like it's going to be cloudy, but still get to experience some of it. I've been told that when it happens, there's a real fast shadow that comes across that's kind of shocking that I've never heard about. And then the other thing is, of course, if you can see it, the sky goes dark and you can actually see the stars. So I hate that we're going to maybe miss that, but that's the way it goes.
Well, we'll see. Our weathermen seem to be wrong most of the time, so we'll hope that they're wrong with the with this forecast. But we saw, earlier this year, the so-called annular eclipse, where it wasn't a complete eclipse. We saw some of that weird shadow. Didn't really know how to explain it at the time, but you'd look at things and think that it was just a trick of the light, so to speak. And I don't remember. We were, the last almost total eclipse, or depending on where you were, total eclipse was just a few years ago, and it covered the northwestern United States. And we were kind of accidentally up in Portland at that time. We went up for the Far West Nursery Show. We were wondering why it was so hard to get a rent car, why hotel rooms were so expensive. And we found out because there was going to be an eclipse. And it was interesting. We didn't experience any of that weird shadow effect. It may have been there, and we just didn't know what to look for. But it was interesting. We were actually sitting the hotel that we stay when we go up for the Far West Show, which we don't do every year, but it's very much worthwhile. But it's right down on the Willamette River, and we were sitting down on the patio of one of the restaurants there, and they have a big flock of Canadian geese are on the river there. And sure enough, the sun started disappearing, and they all came up on the bank and tucked their heads underneath their wings, and, just like they were all going to bed for the night. So it was very interesting to experience, and I don't know, I hope people get to see it, but we'll all experience the darkness, that's for sure. And they're saying, and again, I don't know how we've got our glasses to view it, and I don't know if there's any way to get any more magnification, but may be able to see during that period of what they call totality. They may say we may even see a comet in the sky. So it's going to be very interesting.
Yeah. I look forward to experiencing whatever we get.
And it won't happen again in this part of the world for another 40 years or so, so we better enjoy it while we can.
Yeah, it's going to be tough for you and me to get that next.
Well, never say never. We'll always remain optimistic, but let's make the most of it this time around. But love the pictures of the I just got a chance to look at them briefly between calls, but looks like the new gardens are coming along really well now.
Yeah, we I had the forms pulled off the concrete. The bed preparation is already underway now, and gathering the plants, so I'll be able to show you the finished thing maybe as early as next week. It's looking good. Those other pictures I sent you, the flowers, were of my recent trip. Went to see Logan and Bo in Tucson.
Oh, really? Okay.
Caught a really pretty window of flowering. The bristle bush, which is one of those shots I sent you, just that dramatic yellow mass foliage, that was in full bloom everywhere. And the four nerve daisies are in bloom all over the place. Really, really pretty. Pink penstemon, a specific pink, I'm not sure exactly what species it is, but it was a pink penstemon that was gorgeous and everywhere. In fact, Bo and Logan have a really nice stand of it in their front yard. And the creosote bush was in full bloom, and I've never seen it in full bloom like that. It's really pretty. You know, back in the day when I did the herb book with Odina Branham, one of her big deals was that she traveled out to the West off and on and talked about trying to collect creosote bush, and acted like it was kind of hard to find for some strange reason. And she told me that she thought that it being used as a medicinal herb could actually cure cancer of certain kinds. But anyway, it was in full bloom, very spectacular. The senna, which some people call cassia, I guess, was in full bloom. So the yellows were the dominant flower, and really, really beautiful. They've had a lot of rain. I think that's probably the reason why they're having such a show this year. The cactus were not in bloom yet. They were just starting to pop out, so that's going to be coming. The Ocotea cactus were starting to show a little red at the tips, but most of the cactus covered in buds, and it's going to be a beautiful show probably in a week or so, but they hadn't started yet. One of the most interesting things was, in one of those pictures I sent you, was aloe, maybe aloe vera, in bloom in the shade under trees at one of the nature museums we went to, and I saw that in more than one place, and I've known you can grow aloe vera in the shade for a long time, but I've never seen it in full bloom so beautifully like that in the shade.
Most unusual. It sounds like it was a great trip. Sounds like your timing was just about perfect to catch these things. And that's the thing about, you know, the more desert-like climates. When they bloom, they are spectacular. Sometimes it can be a long time in between. And it's an interesting point, too. I rarely ever see creosote bush offered by any of the native nurseries, and I don't know why. It's an interesting plant, and of course I experienced it in West Texas in my summers in the wildlife management area out there, and it's just absolutely, and you've probably experienced it, that when a little storm is brewing and it's getting ready to rain, my gosh, the fragrance, something about the sudden increase in humidity in the air. Anyway, that's just one of the most fragrant smells. It's not really a pleasant smell because it smells kind of like creosote, but I guess I'd say it's one of the most highly aromatic plants I've ever encountered.
It really is.
And it's just interesting the way that it does it and the timing on when it does it.
Really is. And why Odina had the thought that it was hard to find, I don't know, because it's all over the place there in Tucson. And I would think it'd be, a large percentage of the Sonoran Desert.
Mm-hmm.
One thing I've never seen at all, and I look forward to, they're going to get some pictures because it'll be coming up in the next few weeks, but I have never seen the saguaros in bloom.
Really?
I don't think I've ever even seen it. I've seen one picture because we were talking about it when we were together, but I've never seen them in bloom. They apparently bloom the last of all the cacti.
I, thinking back to that, I, and I've spent a little time in Arizona, not a whole lot, but I don't think I've ever seen saguaros in bloom. And they're certainly interesting plants. They're just fascinating to me that you know, that something can grow that big and with a trunk that size. They're just an unusual cactus that I just feel very privileged every time I get to see them out there.
Well, it's spectacular. They're the national park there. They've protected just this enormous wide stand of them. And some of them are so big it's unreal. There's a lot of saguaros right around them, right in through the residential development where Bo and Logan live. So it's cool. The flowers apparently form kind of a halo right at the the top of the vertical growth of the things. And this is going to be happening, like I said, in a week or maybe two. They weren't even showing any buds on this trip. Didn't see too much wildlife. We expected to see a bunch of, we saw some lizards, no snakes, a lot of bunny rabbits, which always surprises me how bunny rabbits survive in an area like that with coyotes running around all over the place. I have no idea, but they seem to manage it pretty well.
And interesting bird life, too. I remember the little cactus wrens that you see around the big saguaros, and I'm surprised at how many hummingbirds they have out in those more desert-like areas. And, of course, you can always bring them in with the feeder, but you wouldn't think of that as being a place where there was enough natural production of nectar and things to keep those guys going. But some of the prettiest swarms, literally, of hummingbirds that I've ever seen have been in areas like that. So Bo and Logan have a unique and beautiful environment out there.
Well, it's really more spectacular than I was expecting. That last photograph that I sent you, if you got it yet, is a little video of a hummingbird in that penstemon I was telling you about.
Ah, okay. You know, I just did commercial breaks. So I was trying to go through those, and I will certainly spend some more time a little bit later taking a closer look at it. But it sounds like you had a great trip.
Yeah, it's fun. Good restaurants there, too. Found a couple of new places. And Logan came up with a recipe. I'm going to make her send it to me, so I'll share it with you guys. Two things. One, wild-caught salmon, but even tastier than that was a lentil dish that she came up with and has a couple of little techniques to make it that I've never even heard of, and, man, it was good.
Ah, sounds like fun. Sounds like fun. Your daughter married well and has brought between four-legged grandkids and the two of them, you've got some fun things in your life.
Yeah, little Rio, the rescue, she was doing good. It was good to see her and Midge both. But anyway, I'm going to try to catch up on a little gardening myself today. We've got some more rain coming. It continues to be interesting how much rain we've had and how well it has been spread out so that the plants are really looking pretty this year.
We envy you that. We've had the rains that have made it, you know, just beautiful, but we haven't had the really thorough soaking rains that we really need to put the water back in the aquifers. The lakes are still very low around here. The rivers are very low, but golly, the vegetation is just lush this year, and we're seeing weird things. I think it's a combination of the severe heat and drought last summer, and then that one really, really period of cold weather that we had in January. And it's interesting. Pecan trees here have barely begun to leaf out. I think most of them are going to, you know, leaf out pretty well, pretty completely. But they're the slowest trees by far to come out here. And we're seeing places where, you know, trees, and I'm thinking of chinquapin oaks and in a couple of cases, Monterey oaks, that it's like half the tree is leafed out and the other half hasn't. I've heard that from people about fruit trees, about peach trees, and suddenly just, you know, a proportion of the top of the tree hasn't leafed out yet. I haven't seen enough, haven't looked carefully enough to see whether they're truly dead or whether things are just coming out in a weird way. But it's been an unusual watching things come out this spring. And yet lots of things are just fully leafed out. The oaks, for the most part, the live oaks, are just covered with beautiful new foliage. Our all cypress, or maybe the leaves are maybe halfway out on them, but just an unusual year.
Well, maybe that combination of several winters of really pretty severe, at least part of the winter, pretty severe, followed by that intense heat last summer. I trimmed some dead out of some of my real big species Japanese maples.
Yeah.
And I was noticing there in Tucson, the mesquite tree in their front yard looks like it has a lot of dead limbs in it that they're going to be pruning out. So I think there's a combination of the weather events and just because it's been weird slowness, but there is some dead in some of the trees like that.
I've been relieved to see that thus far we have not had, I was afraid this was going to be here when some of the little caterpillars that damage the new foliage coming out on the trees and all were going to be abundant. But so far this year, it seems to be pretty much the normal load. I think stress plants, I think plants that are not under the organic program are, as always, going to have a few more insect problems. But overall, other than just the odd way that some of the things are coming out, I have to say it looks like it's going to be pretty good spring for gardens.
I think so. I heard you talking about banana trees. One of my golf buddies hit me up a couple of days ago about the fact that the banana, which I told him to cut back and cover with mulch back when it turned mushy last beginning of the winter, has not started to reemerge yet. Are you seeing a slowness with those kind of big perennials coming out of the ground?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely, things are. And I think it's because the soil has stayed cool to cold. We're still having mornings. We're supposed to have mornings in the 40s again this week. And one day this past week, I noticed it was like 41 degrees when I got in my car in the morning to, you know, head out. And that's very comfortable weather. Put on a jacket, and it's absolutely wonderful for getting some work done. But it's kept the soil cooler than I think it normally is, and I think that's one of the reasons that things are slower to come out. But
No,
there are a lot of things that and some things that froze back. The variegated flax lilies froze back, and some of the alocasias and some things that normally just bounce right back, they're all slower coming out. And then some of the crazy perennials like the firebush, it's always the last thing to come out, they're still showing absolutely nothing. So it's I hope it stays cool enough that we get a nice long spring out of it. So many years it seems like we just go from, you know, late winter to early summer overnight. But looking at our weather this week, we're looking at 70s for daytime highs and 40s and 50s for nighttime lows, and that's just weather doesn't get much better for gardening than that.
Oh yeah, that's very pleasant. But I think you're exactly right. I think that's what's holding back some of the plants. The other weird thing that I've seen is some perennials that don't necessarily perennialize all that well have. I've got dianthus, for example, in a couple of beds coming back from last year and stuff like that. So there's several head scratchers going on out there.
Well, there are sure some pretty new dianthus out there as well. We get sort of overwhelmed by the shorter varieties that are grown as bedding plants, but we've had trouble getting some of our favorites. One of my favorites is one called First Love that comes out almost waist high, and it's so fragrant. And my observation, and I don't know that it's justified, but some of the taller varieties, if they take the summers, then they take the winters better. The taller varieties seem to be much more tolerant of cold weather and have the tendency to not make, you know, long-term perennials, but come back for two or three or four years in the garden. And, some of the new colors and things are just outstanding. That's again, one of my favorite groups of plants.
I agree.
Well, as always, it's just interesting to talk about what we're seeing. Things are lush and green. I don't know how much time you spent on the highways, but we made a trip over to Houston for a doctor's checkup this past week, and the wildflowers are, they're scattered, and in places are just absolutely spectacular, and in other places you don't see as many, but seeing different colors of paintbrush, and I think these are not necessarily things that have been planted, but we always see a few of the yellows, but saw a couple of stands of almost pure white Indian paintbrush along the road, and you know, a few places that little Drummond's Phlox, that really red one that I just love, seems to be a little bit more prolific, and it's been a pretty year. It's been a good spring for gardening, and looks like hopefully it's going to continue with moderate weather for at least a while. I haven't looked at the Farmer's Almanac. I don't know what the forecast is for this summer, if we're going to be unusually hot again, but for right now it's really nice weather for gardening.
Yeah, the blue bonnets, I was driving Uber in from the airport late yesterday afternoon, and it caught my eye how pretty the blue bonnets were in certain areas, and I thought it was going to be really held, they were going to be held back because we had such heavy growth of rescue grass and mm-hmm. other kind of things because of all the rain that we've had. Mm-hmm. But the bluebonnets, almost like they worked their way up high enough in all of that greenness to come out, and were really pretty spectacular.
Yeah,
right along the highway on 114 yesterday.
Oh, we're seeing the same thing. And the places where they're usually beautiful, they're thicker and more prolific than ever. And other places that we're not used to seeing as many are just solid. I'm not sure what it is about the weather. I'm sure the fact that the rainfall has been, like you said, the timing has been so good that we've had almost continuous moisture available. But it's like just all of a sudden things were just right for a higher percentage of the seed than usual to sprout and grow. I think it also helped because once the little rosette got started in the fall, we continued to have the moisture to sustain them through the winter months, so that now that the bluebonnets have gone into their second phase of their growth, that the flowers are so pretty. And it looks like the idiots at the highway department don't mow, looks like we'll have extremely heavy seed production this year, and that'll fit us for years to come.
Well, y'all check out my latest column. I had something caught my eye, or actually the guy that is my producer, runs the board and everything for my show, sent me a recent article from some officials at the state telling people what to do about oak wilt. And guess what they're recommending?
Tell
me. Cut the trees down or treat them with propiconazole. Nothing else mentioned. So I commented on that and got to do a little update of my sick tree treatment column. So everybody check that out. It'll be up there in the top right-hand corner of dirtdoctor.com.
So they're basically just, and same thing down here, they're just saying the same line that I first heard that 40 years ago at the first oak wilt conference ever held. Yep. And yet we're still seeing just amazing results with both prevention and cure up to a point, you know, with
they're
the, with
gone
the cornmeal.
Too far. That's right.
Yep. One other thing that I wanted to ask, even if we're just running our time over a little bit here, but are you seeing... People down here are saying they're seeing something they're calling boxwood blight. And what I'm seeing in boxwood is, I think, mostly stress-related. But are you seeing or hearing about a specific pathogen hitting boxwoods now?
You know, I've been looking at boxwood problems since I've been in the business. I remember way back when I first got started in the landscape business, I was running into that, and other people were telling me about it, and clients were asking me about it, and we assumed at that point that it was some kind of pathogen and some kind of built-in weakness, and I quit designing them into projects a long time ago. and went to dwarf yaupon and other kinds of things. But yeah, I think they have a weakness. I think they're kind of like roses that are susceptible to you know, certain diseases. You've got kind of a built-in weakness if the stress is there from watering too much or not enough, or you know, too much synthetic fertilizer or whatever. So I tell people, any woody plant, doesn't have to be just a tree, but any woody plant will respond to that sick tree treatment kind of thing. And it addresses, you know, builds up the biological activity. I think whole ground cornmeal used around the plants, if you're going to just do one thing, probably is a good thing to do for anybody that has boxwood.
Well, and we're recommending that, and also recommending, the people that are saying there is some viral component to it, to use the hydrogen peroxide.
I think that'd be a good idea.
But I look at the ones in front of my house that I think are probably over 100 years old. My house is, you know, approaching 110, 115 years old, and I think the boxwoods have been there darn near that long. And they're the old-fashioned Japanese, and just one of the hardier things out there. But like you say, sick tree treatment, and we saw some, some plantings of drift roses. That's a little rose I'm just not impressed with any more than the knockouts. But, boy, just every plant with the rosette on it, and try to tell people that about getting out there with the peroxide and cutting out damaged foliage, that there are things that can be done. But we're getting the same thing down here. The Extension Service is just saying, oh, if they get that, just pull them up and replace them. And same story they've been telling, despite all the evidence to the contrary.
Yeah, it's at least worth trying it. I'd spray the hydrogen peroxide one time, put some whole ground cornmeal on the ground, and if you have the time and the budget for it, do the entire sick tree treatment. You probably get them turned around, even if they're symptomatic. And that'll all work as a preventive measure as well. So,
well, good stuff, and as always, so much more to talk about. Tell Bo and Logan hello for me when you talk to them, and give the dogs a pet, and I suggest we do this again next Saturday.
Been fun as always. See you guys next week.
And hopefully we'll get to discuss the eclipse or lack of then. So, Howard, again, many thanks to you. And everybody out there, dirtdoctor.com, best source on the Internet for gardening information that is accurate, that works, that is organic. Let's see here. Greg, I don't believe I think I've taken care of all of my commercials, so let's run what we need to and record it and be back with time to take a few more phone calls.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster is on the air. News Talk 550 KTSA and FM 107.1.
All right, let's get back to gardening. And looks like Ron and Robin and Robert, three R's there, all have questions. And let's just get started. And Ron's in first in line. Good morning, Ron.
Hello, Bob.
How are you?
A couple questions. I'm doing well, and I hope you are as well.
Absolutely.
Hey, I got a question about azomite.
Mm-hmm.
I bought a box of azomite, maybe 2-3 years ago, and it was like in a powder form.
Uh-huh.
And I went on Google for a search because the supply that I've got is pretty much depleted, and I thought I'd order some more. And I see it comes in a granular form also now. I didn't know if it did back when I bought a couple of years ago. But anyway, I guess my question is, if I understand it, azomite is a derivative of a volcanic stone, is it?
Yes. Yeah. It is. And I'm sorry, I think it comes out of Nevada. It has, as you've discovered, the unusual quality of just a huge number of micronutrients and compounds, and it is volcanic in origin. At one time, they made three different forms. They also had a molasses-coated form that I absolutely loved. I think it was a little bit harder to, you know, keep it from getting hard in the bag, so they discontinued that. But they do have it in a granular form that's, you know, it's not as big as an English pea. It's probably probably just a little bit smaller than rock salt, if that gives you a size comparison.
Okay.
And I like using that on shrubs and things, just, you know, grab it and just sling it around. The powdered form that you mentioned, they call micronizing. It actually breaks it down into such a small particle that as long as you continue to agitate, you can mix it with water and spray it. It, of course, doesn't dissolve, doesn't go into solution, but it does go into suspension. I usually use a little heavier granules, just easier than having to get the hose and the sprayer out. But both of them work extremely well.
Okay. I have difficulty understanding that if something comes from a rock or something similar to a rock, is it similar the way, does it dissolve like Epsom salt or something, or does it just remain suspended in the form that you put it in? I'm trying to figure out what it contributes to the benefit of the soil for the plant. In the form of a rock, like, I look like sand. Sand adds to the texture of the soil, I guess, you know,
sure.
Keeping it loose and so forth.
Well, my take on it, and I'm not sure what percentage of the different micronutrients that are in it that this applies to, but the way that, you know, a good rich soil accesses rock powder, so to speak, is that the roots of the plants produce carbon dioxide. Carbon dioxide combines with moisture in the soil to form carbonic acid, which is a very mild acid, which works to make some of these things which have been bound, you know, in a, I don't know whether it's a crystalline matrix or exactly what structure it's in, but the carbonic acid tends to put these things into a size that plants can absorb and use. It in effect puts it into solution, although it's been demonstrated that plants can absorb larger particles through their roots than we originally thought. But I think it's, you know, it's the action of the carbonic acid. I know this is how it works on a lot of different things that are added to the fertilizers, but it's the carbonic acid that begins kind of etching away or leaching away at the rock powders that, and making them more available to the plants. I need to go back and read or reread in some cases some of Phil Callahan's work. He's been dead for a number of years, but he was one of the early people that really promoted what he called the rock powders. And as a person who enjoys researching things, you might Google Phil Callahan and see what you find in some of his books and papers, because he wrote more widely and researched more widely on some of the rock powders than anyone who has lived before or since. And I don't recall whether he really addressed that or not, but that is how I interpret, and that's how I interpret some of the things that I have seen, and that the more organic material is in the soil, the more quickly you see the results. And the organic material is producing, you know, carbon dioxide. The roots of the plants are releasing carbon dioxide through their metabolism, and that forming the carbonic acid is what's freeing up a lot of the nutrients in azomite, as well as green sand and just ordinary lava sand and some other things as well.
Okay. Hey, one quick question for you. You have a greenhouse operation there in San Antonio, I believe, correct?
We have a retail nursery. We don't.
Okay.
We used to have a big growing operation on my ranch up in Burney, but some import laws changed that kind of put us out of that business. But no, we have a retail nursery gift shop is my business.
Okay. Are you familiar with grow plugs? Is that something that you've seen? I was at our local college here, and they were the students who work in the greenhouse there. Had a rack of growing, they called them grow plugs. They're only about 3/4 inch opening at the top, about an inch deep, and they have a drainage hole in the bottom. And they come in big sheets similar to the sheets that you buy 6-packs and 4-packs
right.
To start seeds, you know. And I was wondering, how in the dickens do they get the little plants without damaging them out of the, those little plugs like that. Have you seen any of those at all in your operation?
We don't. You know, we see a little bit of it, and we avoid it.
Okay.
I think, you know, they say, oh, yeah, these plugs and just like the so-called peat pots, oh, they're going to break down and the roots are going to go right through them. Uh-uh.
Yeah.
I've pulled up things after a vegetable garden, and the roots have barely made it out of the grow plug or out of the little pot they were growing in. So I know people down here have experimented with them, and our caller we all refer to as Farmer James may have done some, and I'm sure maybe next week he'll fill us in on a little bit more of that. But I have never had real good luck with a preformed material like that. I still like a loose open material that the roots go right through anyway.
Okay. Well, hey, thank you, Bob. Enjoy talking.
Always good to talk to you, Ron. And I'm there. You might Google if you have trouble finding the azomite. The distributor is a company called Micromin, MICROMIN. You might Google Micromin Solutions and see if they might have a way of getting some of the material up to you. You're in Branson, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Anyway, call back if we can help you locate a little bit more
okay.
of it. And
I appreciate it.
Well, it's my pleasure. Greg, let's get our last break of the show in here and then get in working Robin and Robert as best we can.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster. News Talk 550 KTSA and FM 107.1.
All right, back to gardening. Looks like this is going to work out pretty well. Should have time to talk to both Robin and Robert. We start with Robin. Good morning, Robin.
Good morning, Bob.
Good morning.
I'm so thankful to get through. I've been trying for 2 weeks.
Well, I'm glad you made it. How can I help today?
Yeah. Well, I have two questions. First question is I was raising four pipevine caterpillars that
uh-huh.
were brought to me on a Dutchman's pipevine, a very
right.
small one in a little container. And I was so delighted. Well, I had to feed them. And I called all over, well, my side of town, trying to find a nursery that had a Dutchman's pipevine. This was about 3 weeks ago,
uh-huh.
maybe a month. And the only place I could find one was at Rainbow. And it was a huge, it was a $40 plant.
Right.
And I went ahead and bought it because I couldn't find anything else. And I was so glad I did because those caterpillars were eating like crazy. Well, the first week they did great. They seemed real happy with the plant. The second week, I noticed they just were behaving differently. And it was like they were upset and they were crawling all over the cage. They weren't really eating that much. And they were, and then the third week they weren't growing. They just weren't growing, and they were deteriorating. And finally, they all ended up like they were fried. Just mm-hmm. they lost their little red spots. They all died. So I was thinking, what could have happened? They could have been parasitized before I got them, or the Dutchman's pipevine that I bought. Maybe was contaminated with some kind of systemic insecticide, or
well, probably wasn't systemic. It probably was. So many growers spray with BT, Bacillus thuringiensis, and
yes.
that's sort of one of the signs of BT poisoning. And unfortunately, you know, it's hard to find growers that don't use it. Botanically, pipevine is called Aristolochia, and they're quite spectacular plants, but they're pretty hard to come by. And I'm not sure exactly how you would clean them. If you ever run into this again, you could probably try cleaning the leaf surfaces with hydrogen peroxide or something like that. But better still, and you can grow the pipevine yourself, and it's a beautiful plant. But do you still have the plant? You lost the caterpillars,
yes.
But
yes, I
okay.
have the plant. I want
okay.
to put it in the ground.
Yeah, well, clean the leaves as best you can. Perhaps take some cuttings. You can grow new plants from cuttings of your existing vine and just try to get some, you know, good, clean, new foliage. The BT is not systemic. It doesn't move through the vascular system of the plant, so future leaves that come out should be totally safe for the little caterpillars. And I applaud you for doing so. The pipevine swallowtail is certainly an interesting butterfly, and we do have some little native aristolochias that, but there are just not many of them out there. But it sounds like you just had some BT poisoning. Clean the leaves as best you can, and in the future, try to find out from the people you're buying them from if they know if they were grown in a pesticide-free environment.
So would I just take like a cotton ball and soak it with hydrogen peroxide and wipe each leaf? Is that how
you could do that, or you could use just a little bit of dish soap to clean them and maybe just a wipe off with the peroxide, but just a little sponge probably would be easier than a cotton ball. But just mix up some dish soap, add a little bit of peroxide to it, and that probably would be the way to go. Robin, I'm going to hold you there because I want to get Robert in because he has been waiting. Robert, you've got about 2.5 minutes here.
Okay, yeah, I got it all written down, Bob. Thank you very much
okay.
for taking my call.
Certainly.
I got some flowers. I bought some in Beaumont. It was kind of home, mom and pop shop. And I brought them here, and they're kind of like moth color, and they're about 3 to 4 inches, you know. And they come out red, and then they turn to a moth color. How would I be? I transplanted them from a 3-gallon pot to a 5-gallon this past week, and I used some potting mix and I used some compost. And I read a little bit online where it said to add some Epsom salt. You ever heard of that?
Well, Epsom salt's basically magnesium sulfate, and some plants really benefit from it, others don't. But what it's doing is rebalancing the calcium and magnesium in the soil. It really helps roses grow and bloom better. And with tomato plants, it keeps them from getting this syndrome called blossom end rot. It's not a pathogen. It's actually a physiological problem that happens when the calcium and magnesium get out of balance. But you won't hurt anything with Epsom salts. Some plants will benefit from it. Others won't, but you never hurt anything. If you're going to put it on in a liquid form, about 2 tablespoons per gallon of water is what you would do. Okay. In the case of tomato plants, we just sprinkle it on the surface of the soil in water.
Okay. All right. Let me ask you one more other question. These flowers also, they come up about 3 or 4 flowers in a bouquet. Do I have to prune them off after I get that much growth on there?
No, not at all. I'm still not sure exactly what. Do you have a name on this plant?
No, it didn't. I just liked it. You know, it's a mom and pop shop. You know, and then I got another one that.
Yeah,
go ahead.
Take a photograph of this one that you like, and take it to your own local nursery and get somebody to take a close look at it and see if they can identify it. I can tell you a whole lot more about how to grow it if we can figure out what it is.
Okay. Let me ask you another question before. One of the important things I want to do, I want to put some compost around my yard. Of course, I live here in Timberwood Park, so we got half an acre. But is there an organization? I mean, my buddy was telling me there's five companies here in San Antonio. Yeah.
Robert, I'm going to have to hold you there. I'm just out of time. Let's talk tomorrow here on the air. Right now, it's time for Martin Bomba right here on KTSA Radio, San Antonio, Texas.